work on the Congress. In Congress, it's the industries that profit off of
the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with Sharon Green, a homeowner who was able to keep her home out of the foreclosure arena and able to navigate through some government help and, you know, able to save her house, stabilize part of her community. Today, you know, she was here in Harrisburg talking about her experience, Here's what gets me. And when Governor Corbett took office, you know, he said, we're going to tighten the ship. We're going to do all these things. We're going to, you know, cut. The programs that help people like you and me, those are the programs that got cut. And this HEMAP program, this Homeowners Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program, was one of those that he slashed and burned. And she's going to talk about how the program helped her. That's what's important here. And to me, it's these kind of programs that directly help people that I think are so important, and they're so important to talk about because the Republicans have spent so much time, and a number of Bentney conservative Democrats have spent so much time trying to privatize, trying to profitize, and trying to make things look like it isn't government actually doing it. I actually want to know what my government is doing so I can oversee it and I can hold it accountable. You know, when you throw all this stuff in there where we blur the lines between what is public and what is private, you open it up to a lot of trouble. So we're going to talk to her about her experience with the program, maybe talk a little bit about how we can get out of this housing crisis that we seem to be perpetually in. And if they'd listened to me from the beginning, what we should have done is what we did after the Great Depression, which started the Home Ownership Loan Corporation, and say, look, we're going to fund this. We're going to make sure that people who can afford to keep their homes, keep their homes. People have a little tough time. We're going to make things work. So we stabilize neighborhoods. That stuff is important. So it'll be interesting talking to her. Also, Laura Clausen, labor editor at the Daily Kos, is going to hit us with the labor news. Eric Tarz, children's rights director, he's going to be here talking about this report that just came out. Again, another one of these moments where we're spending a lot of money getting kids to school. Turns out they're homeless. There's actually something out there that says that there's homeless children, you have to bus them to the school. Shouldn't we be finding homes for them? Well, Eric's going to talk a little bit about that. And also in the third hour, John Logan, director and professor of labor studies at San Francisco State University, is going to be here talking about the Boeing situation. And again, you got to love on the day that they hand deliver this giant plane to the all Nippon airline, there's still information out there that Boeing was working to retaliate against their workers. Amazing stuff. So I don't know if you noticed today, the distractions are in full swing, talking about the big rig, talking about voter ID, talking about how do we stop abortions again, the abortion issue front and center, a whole bunch of distraction. talking about today how we averted a shutdown. Oh, the crisis that was averted by, you know, this grand little deal that they, which used to be common sense, used to be something that just happened. Now it's a big to-do. Now it's something that, well, we were at the brink and we saved ourselves. All distractions. We should be talking about how to create jobs. We should be talking about how to get this economy moving for people like you and me. Pretty simple. How do we help people? How do we help people like Sharon Green stay in their home and the millions of other people who are on the brink of foreclosure? How do we do that? And I say we have to do that through our government. Our government needs to act, not be constantly gridlocked, not be tied up and marred in this bizarre me struggle that continues on. And we can't keep doing it through these private actors. We need to do it through us. We the people, of, for, and by we the people. I look at what's going on in New York. You got these kids who, Tea Party people, these are the folks you need to be afraid of. We don't need to be afraid of the Tea Party people. We've seen the best that they've got to offer. These kids who are out in New York and soon will be out in other cities across the country, these are the people that we've got to be worried about. These are the people that Republicans and Democrats really have to worry about. For people like you and me, working people, we need to be pushing them on, saying, yes, stand, fight the fight. Fight the greed. Fight Wall Street. Change the system. You know, I had an interesting conversation with a friend today, and he was telling me the tale of his youth, and we were talking about Vietnam and how during Vietnam, how everything kind of changed almost overnight, in his opinion. Up until they instituted the draft lottery, most people were like they are today, pretty complacent. Well, that's poor people. You know, hey, college kids, they get to go to college. They're fine. Don't worry about it. But as soon as they put that lottery in there, where everybody now was the possibility that you could be going, that really got people involved. And it got young people involved. And you look at what's going on in this economy. You get kids who are graduating from college with massive debt because they were told all through their school years, from the moment they're in the womb, you have to go to college to get a good job. You have to be a doctor, a lawyer, whatever. You have to be something with a degree. And they followed that path. They went off to college, they got degrees, and they came out, and guess what? No job. And on top of no job, guess what? Massive debt. And that massive debt just keeps accumulating and accumulating and accumulating until eventually you're never going to get out from under it, because understand, student loans you can never default on. It's kind of like herpes. It's going to follow you forever. And I keep going back to this, while what's going on in New York still doesn't have its legs yet, there still isn't a direction, a solid direction, there's some activity. And that's why you're seeing so much. When I was down there, when I was in New York a couple weekends ago, there was overwhelming police presence. And if you look at some of the videos that are being shot there, I mean, the police presence is just, I go back to Jay Gould, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And you look at these cops who, you got to imagine that the cops are ticked off because the Wall Street people are the ones who pretty much stole their pensions. You would think on some natural level that the cops would be kind of in favor of fighting back against the people who stole their pensions. But here again, there's no real direction. I hope at some point when there is direction that we're able to get behind that and really make a movement out of it. Because that's the answer. It's direct action. It's us becoming involved. It's having Occupy Wall Street. It's having Occupy Main Street. It's having Occupy, the Capitol steps. It's here Occupy every street with people who get what the problem is. And the problem is we're too much of an unequal society. We seem to think that the wealth class cares what happens to the economy, cares what happens to us. And the reality is it's not that at all. They care as long as they get to keep the winnings. And like I talked about yesterday, the stockbroker guy who said, you know what? We're waiting for the next recession. We're going to profit off of it. Because you look at the last recession. the massive transfer of wealth from people like you and me to those guys on Wall Street, to the hedge fund billionaires who, unlike you, every dime you earn is taxed at a 28% rate or whatever economic class you fall into. When they make their millions, 15% capital gains. We've made it to where work is almost a dirty thing. Or if you actually work for your living, that somehow that's something to look down on if you look at the tax code. Personally, I think it should be the other way around. If you sit around and do nothing and collect dividend checks, I think maybe just a thought that that should at least be taxed at the same rate as someone who goes out in days like today when it's raining to make sure that the electric lines don't hurt people, or when the roads closed, you got cops out there to make sure that, well, you know, people don't get hurt. Eh, just a thought. And the more I look at this, the more I look at how unequal and how divided we are, I'm worried. I'm worried that, you know, on some level, we only end up at each other's throats. And that cannot happen. Now, the power elite, the money elite, that's what they want. They want people sliced and diced and divided and at each other, because then we can't unite against them. You know, I was just, before we came on air, I was just looking at the Forbes 400, looking at the billionaire class, because every one of the 400, now billionaires, you got to wonder how many of those actually have income and how many of them actually make their living through capital gains. I look at my favorite billionaire, and I have a favorite billionaire, and I think everyone should, since we seem to value billionaires and we seem to value extreme wealth in this country over helping the homeless and the hungry and kids who have nowhere to sleep, but, you know, we bus them to school. My favorite billionaire is Shots Piscotty. Shots made his billions the old-fashioned way, outsourcing jobs from this country to everywhere else around the globe and taking his cut to do it. Good American value job, you know, destroy the American economy. But you know what? You can put some coin in your pocket. He's also the owner of the Baltimore Ravens. Another reason not to like him. But, you know, here's the reality. He figured out how to pry the Cleveland Browns out of the city of Cleveland and bring it to Baltimore. And good for him. And I loved in the bio, it said, you know, he's had sellouts since 1996. It didn't mention that the state of Maryland guaranteed 10 years of those buyouts. Didn't mention that at all. But here's the thing. I mean, if we're going to value these billionaires, if we're going to value this national treasure that we seem to have and seem to be so hell-bent on protecting, because we heaven forbid, we ask them, since they have all this wealth, to give a little bit of it back. Since we seem to treasure this so much, we should all have a favorite, I think. And he is mine, number 331, up from 356, I think, last year. So, again, he's doing a lot better, and that's good, and we should be proud of that on a national level because, you know, we can't make a decent piece of electronics. We can't, you know, build a bicycle in this country anymore. We seem to love the fact that we can outsource all of that. But we've got billionaires, and we're going to protect their tax code. We're going to protect their tax breaks. And, you know, maybe even Herman Cain will come in, be president, and do his 999 plan. Lower their taxes and raise ours. Got to love that. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Sharon Green, a homeowner and, you know, lucky recipient, I guess, of some sound government investment. We're going to take a quick break back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The lockout of union nurses at Sutter Hospitals in California is supposed to end today. Authorities, meanwhile, are investigating the death of a patient at the Alta Bates Summit Medical Center. The patient reportedly died after getting a non-prescribed dosage of a medical drug by one of the replacements hired to fill in when thousands of nurses went on a one-day strike. The nurses were locked out when they tried to return from strike. California Nurses Association has filed a complaint with the State Department of Public Health. The union says it's concerned that replacements brought in have the certifications and competency to do their jobs. The nurses union has held candlelight vigils at the hospital, calling on Sutter to end the lockout. The nurses are supposed to be able to return to work today. A new report highlights modern-day slavery in the tobacco fields of the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
A report released last week by the Farm Labor Organizing Committee and Oxfam America exposed a culture in North Carolina of tobacco workers facing near slavery. Findings revealed that 1 in 4 workers are paid less than minimum wage, with a majority saying they don't make enough to meet basic needs. The majority of the workers interviewed for the comprehensive study said they had regular bouts of green tobacco sickness, which comes from absorbing nicotine through the skin. A lack of training and the necessary clothing were both blamed for the reoccurring sickness. North Carolina law requires fresh water to be available for field workers, but the workers said that often isn't the case. Heat stroke is the number one cause of death for farm workers in the state. Workers also face poor living conditions, with most dealing with inadequate plumbing, insect and rodent infestations, worn beds, leaky roofs, and no heat or ventilation. The authors recommend tobacco manufacturers become part of the solution by providing growers with the opportunity to inform pricing. They also recommend a council being created that brings workers, growers, and manufacturers to the same table to make sure growers have the tools for a safe and legal workforce.
Here's a look at the economic numbers game through working class eyes. As the United States endures a possible double-dip recession, the safety net for the unemployed is slowly eroding. Figures from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis show that the amount of money spent on unemployment insurance is in steep decline. Over the past 2 years, payments related to unemployment insurance peaked at $152.8 billion in the first quarter of 2010. In the second quarter of 2011, those payments had dropped to $107.3 billion and are expected to decline into the foreseeable future. This newscast brought to you in part by the United Mine Workers of America. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the loving cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. You got a question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So this afternoon, the folks from the Philadelphia Unemployment Project were in town to rally against the governor's cutting the Home Owners Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program, or HEMAP. Another one of these things Corbett has done. Again, I said this before. He said he was going to, slash and burn. And this is one of the victims of the slash and burn. But before it all went away, some people were able to be helped by this, and I've got one of those folks on the line. She spoke today at the rally here in Harrisburg, Sharon Green. Thanks for taking time for me. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. I appreciate taking time for me. You were in Harrisburg today at the rally?
Yes, I was.
What were you doing here?
I was in there protesting, having a rally about saving our homes for HEMAP, because they took HEMAP away,
right,
which is one of our important loan applications that we can get to help save our homes. It's not a loan that it's not a giving loan. It's a loan that we pay back off. They took it away, and it was with us since 1985.
So here's another one of these programs that designed to help folks in their time of need, that we've got a governor who's slashing away. Explain your situation to us. I understand that you were going through the foreclosure process, and through the Philadelphia Unemployment Project, you were able to file some paperwork. Explain how this all worked.
Okay. I was going through losing my home back in October. I had a hard time trying to figure out how to handle this, but I got introduced to PUB, which is the Public Unemployment Project, and then I got introduced to these guys, and they told me how to go about getting a legal aid, a legal lawyer to help me, you know, present this, you know, my actions and to present my actions. And they helped me with my mortgage and then left. It's called EMAP. I'm sorry. It's called ELF. The ELF program helped me to get my loan together to help pay back all my back mortgages and my back payments and my legal aid payments, which worked out pretty good for me because I even lost my home in sheriff's sale.
Oh, wow.
We have helped stop sheriff's sale from people losing their home from the month of January to April. April, when it came back, we couldn't stop the sheriff's sale. And I happen to have been lucky enough to save my home through ELP, which is the last program that we had, which ended in September. But the loan, the mortgage, I mean, the company was supposed to start putting out the loan back in September up until October, up until September of this year. They didn't start until May. That means they only gave out loans enough to people from May to September. Wherever the rest of the money went, we don't know. Then they take HEMAP away. HEMAP is the only last program that we can even get into to help save our homes. It's not a giving loan. It's a loan that we pay back. So they get their money back in the long run. But now we don't have any kind of help at all to help anybody save their home.
And the purpose of, and I've talked about this at some length, the purpose of keeping folks in their home as long as they can make their payments, you get them on the track to where they can, is to stabilize a community so that the value of the entire community doesn't go down.
Right. Because we have more, they put more money into the prison system than they will do for people who are trying to save their home. Can you imagine? If people lose their home, can you imagine how many people that's fighting and striving to survive, who they end up getting themselves into trouble to the point that they end up in the jail system?
Yeah, but
would you rather have people going to jail than people to save their home?
Yes, there's big profit in prisons.
Yeah, big profit. I mean, they make more money with people in prison than they do with people out here in the street.
Well, again, which is why they want to destroy programs like this that help keep people in their homes. The idea being that, you know, they can take that home, they can resell it, and they can make a profit off of it, and have you locked up on top of it.
And even sometimes they don't even resell it. Do you know how many homes we watch that's vandalized, that's abandoned, that's just sitting there and with people, millions and millions of people homeless, and they got homes that's sitting out here that people can be living in, remodel it to be living in. But they'd rather see us in the street. Why? We did a rally today right there in Harrisburg. Do you know it was more people sitting there rallying for people that's going for suicide and going for other things than we had for people who was there behind us for saving your home? Is that a joke?
Well, it's a matter of, you know, people who are directly affected by things. And look, people who are being foreclosed on, the unemployed, the poor, they don't have high-paid lobbyists. They don't have people to organize them like some other issues may, so they don't get seen. Look, I would love to have seen people in Philadelphia today trying to talk to the folks who are lining up to try and get some welfare, to try and maybe get them registered to vote, and then begin talking to them about programs that are going to help them as well. But, you know, it's just the money isn't there for it.
Yeah, the money isn't there for it. But then you have to encourage people. You have to give people something to be encouraged of. You know what I mean? If people say, look, I'm going to lose my home, I'm going to sell something, get welfare. No, that's not what we want you to do. We're here to help you save your home so you can have and live the American dream. Isn't that what they put out there for us?
No, that's what it's supposed to be.
They put out there for us to live the American dream, but they steady trying to belittle us like we just lose our jobs because we don't want to work no more. We may quit. They got us like we don't want to pay our bills and nothing like that. I have actually seen today how much people do not care for people trying to save their home.
It is sad.
It's sad because I don't know if it's because they're not in that predicament. It's because they're not in that predicament or what, but it's sad to see how we sat there and had a rally today about saving your home. We had less people there for saving your home than we had for people who just out there with kids that's committing suicide. I don't condone kids committing suicide. You know, everybody needs help. See, they need help then. You can't see that people need help. I mean, you know, I don't understand.
So, Sharon, let's bring this back to you personally. You got into a little trouble with your mortgage, fell behind a couple of payments. Walk me through that. What happened in your life?
When I had, I was a working citizen. I worked every day. I raised three sons, right? I raised my sons to pay their bills, do not go into debt. I tried, you know, have them not to go into debt. You know, I worked every day. I put in heavy hours, you know, because I'm a single mom. I put in heavy hours to make sure me and my children had the things that they need in life. You see what I'm saying? The basic things.
I hear you.
They need in life. I never took my kids as far as, further than I could take them. I don't live beyond my means or anything like that. I just take them where I can take them. I'd rather been in Harrisburg fighting for my kids to go to college than to be fighting to save my home. But it's more important to me. They took my home. I went in under sheriff's sale. They stole my home. I had to fight, and I fought with everything I had as a single mom, everything I had, to fight to try to get this loan to help save my home. They finally gave me the approval to save my home. The loan people with this help had to call my mortgage company to ask my mortgage company, can you please hold her deed until her loan is approved, and then you'll know for sure that you'll get your money, which they did. Thank Jesus and thank the God that they did that. Because other than that, right now, today, I will be homeless. And I did. We fought that almost a whole year. I've been fighting that since October, and in September. That loan just went through last week.
So now you have a job now, correct?
Not right now. Right now, I'm still looking for a job, but now I got to make sure. I got to secure myself to make sure the job that I seek and find and land right now is enough to make sure my mortgage is paid for, along with my bills that mounted up, and to support my household.
And this all went through, and you're on the right path.
I'm on the right path, you know, and I'm just one of the fortunate ones.
So what do you
know? I'm out here fighting. I already knew that before I even went to Harrisburg today. But I'm out here fighting for all the mouths that can't be spoken for. I'm speaking for them. Because what was given to me, I want to give back. So I'm fighting for those who can't speak for themselves. I'm that mouth for them.
So what do you want people who are listening to do? What action would help? What should we be doing?
You mean the people? You're talking about the people who's trying to seek for help?
I mean them and, you know, folks like me who want to make sure that avenue is available to people who need it. Because, look, you know, while I may not be having problems in my mortgage and in my neighborhood, somebody may. And indirectly, that could affect me by pulling my property values down as well. So I'm going to want to make sure.
My one thing is, put your pride to the side. For once, put your pride to the side. Because, first of all, you need every help you can get. Don't feel embarrassed about anything. Fight for your home. That's all you have. That's all you have. That's all you have for you and your children. Fight for your home because you need a roof over your head. Not easy living in the street. I never lived in the street, but those that I heard and seen, living in the street is not easy.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
You know, what you own is yours. That means you're supposed to protect that every chance and every way you can. I fought to the very end. Fight as far as you can. And those who know, those friends, family, support, get all those people involved with you. Don't be afraid to tell them that you need help. You know, everybody might can't give you dollars and cents, but they can give you all the information, all the knowledge that they can give you to lead you in the right direction. Don't give up.
And that is great advice. Sharon Green, I appreciate the time. Congratulations, and keep up the fight.
Thank you so much, okay?
All righty. We're going to take
a
quick break.
You have a blessed day.
You too. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smith Show. And then there were 12. When the 435 House members and 100 senators failed in July to agree on a long-term deficit reduction plan, the leaders did what they often do when they don't know what to do. they appointed a committee. But don't sneer, for this is, cue the trumpets, a super committee, made up of only a dozen lawmakers and perfectly balanced between Repubs and Dems. This panel is to find about $1.5 trillion in spending cuts and new revenues to shrink the federal deficit. The theory is that the group will be small enough to work together across partisan lines for the good of the country, independent of the competing budgetary needs of various groups and the demands of special interests. The problem with theories is that reality has a way of intruding on their perfection. In this case, the intrusion is literal. The 12 Solons will not be sitting at the table alone, for such names as AT&T, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Citigroup, and GE have been escorted inside by the members. They'll not go in physically, but monetarily, for they are among the top donors of campaign cash to the 12 budgeteers, giving them an advantage over us plain citizens. For example, Wall Streeters have invested $17 million in the campaigns of the Super Committee's 6 Republicans and $15 million in the 6 Democrats. That pile of political money will be a screaming presence in the negotiating room, for members will be thinking about their need to get more of it for the next election and will not want to offend donors. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, one of the first decisions reached by the committee members was that they would allow themselves to continue collecting campaign donations while they decide whose programs and subsidies get cut and whose don't. How do you think that's going to work out?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, they say that there's a greeting card or there's a card for every occasion. Well, I guess you know things are getting bad when Hallmark unveils its layoff cards. That's right, specifically for that special someone who just got canned, got kicked to the curb like trash. Yes, you can get them the unemployed card. A greeting card for every situation. You know, one of the headlines was, don't think of it as losing your job. Think of it as a timeout between stupid bosses. Yeah, I'm sure that'll go over real well on the breadline. So, you know, hey, I guess any way you can make a buck, some of the folks in the article say, well, you know, it's a good idea because someone's thinking about me. And I started thinking about all the ways I've heard people getting fired. Here's an email. Congratulations, you're fired. Or, hey, you call at 8:30 to this certain number and listen to the recorded message tell you that you're fired. Maybe now you'll get a greeting card in the mail. You don't even have to come in. Or maybe they'll send you flowers with a card. Sorry, it's kind of like a funeral, kind of like a death. Yeah, you're going to go hungry for a while. So here, have a card and some flowers. Kind of nuts. I don't know if you saw it today. Thousands of people lined up in Philadelphia, looking for, you know, a month's worth of food stamps to help because there are folks who qualify because of Hurricane Irene. And I thought, you know, here's a perfect opportunity for folks to, you know, organize these people. We don't see lines anymore. That's kind of a thing, you know, the Depression. You know, and I wish we did see lines. I wish people could really see and have a visual of how bad things have really gotten. You know, we've got some, what, 15, 16 million people unemployed? You know, watch, see those people standing in line. That's a powerful visual, which is why, you know, again, the right has done a masterful job of privatizing and streamlining and putting things on the web so that those folks are in the margins. They're in the shadows. They're left in their homes, until they get kicked out of them, of course, where they can't communicate with each other. And better yet, they can't be organized. Because they're in their little shells, and then the depression sits. And I was unemployed a couple of times, and I got to be honest, the one time, it was for several months, and it was probably one of the most horrible things that I ever went through. Because you never thought you were ever going to get a job. You'd send out resume after resume, and I can't imagine because it's bad now. I mean, in '92 when it happened to me, things were bad, but now things are much worse than the Bush recession of '92. Much, much worse. What we need in this country, what we need is not more diversion. What we need is not more, oh, let's rig elections or let's talk about abortion or let's talk about all of the other, the shiny stuff in the room. What we need a jobs plan. We need to get working people back to work. We need to make sure that people at the margin are cared for. We need a smart jobs plan. We need something with a strong safety net. You know, what we've got now, tattered. We need strong unemployment compensation. Well, all I hear are the Republicans, oh, we need to gut it. We need to make sure that folks who need food stamps get it, and there are a lot of people getting food stamps. And the thing is, there are a lot more that could. And we need health insurance for people. We've got some 50 million people uninsured, and that's not the number of uninsured or poorly insured. And, you know, I listen to people like Paul Ryan talk about their market-based approach to healthcare, which is nonsense. All the other cons they've bought into it, oh, we need market solutions. It's a con job. What they're pushing is fatally flawed. Because evidently, or maybe they do understand collusion, which is why they're all in favor of it. You know, the free market only works in healthcare as long as you have informed consumers. And more importantly than informed consumers, having the ability to walk away. You know, if I'm laying on the ground dying of a heart attack, I don't know that I'm in that good of a position to haggle over price. I don't know if grasping my chest and gasping for my last breath, I'm going to be able to negotiate. I think, and you know, maybe you got a better idea, but I think I'm kind of in the negative there. I think I'm in a bad gambling position. And the other thing, has anyone had anything going to orthodontics? My daughter, 9, going to an orthodontist who they take our insurance, but it's only like $700 a year for the insurance. They want like $2,400 for some retainer thing. And you call around to all of the different doctors who do all these orthodontists. You call around, and oddly enough, they're within like $10 of each other. But there's no such thing as collusion. No, no, no. What's amazing to me, they talk about competition. The little thing she's going to put in her mouth, probably about $5 worth of material. And we're going to pay, you know, a couple of $1,000s for someone to put it in. Now, I got to be honest, it's only like an hour or two here or there. I understand paying for someone's education. I understand that completely. But you would think there would be more of a competitive environment. You know why there's not? They know that I'm not going to let my child go through life with twisted teeth. They know that in this culture, not going to happen. So they've got me by the short hairs. I'm informed, completely informed. I know my daughter's teeth are crooked. I know what the price of every orthodontist in the area costs. I got the prices. They're all pretty much the same. I got the information. I just can't walk away. They know they've got me. So, again, when you start talking about healthcare, when you start talking about all this stuff, you got to have the ability to leave. And they know you won't. The other part of this is we need to start getting people jobs. I mean, it's beyond the health care. It's beyond the safety net. It's getting people back to work. So that means helping states balance their budgets, helping states out so that they aren't laying off tens and 20,000 public employees. We need to be creating more public service jobs, because I know there are people in my neighborhood who could use help. We need to increase the funding for infrastructure improvements. We need to repair schools like the president's talking about. We need to put broadband access everywhere. If we're going to be an information society, you got to have people who have the ability to gain that information. There's so many things we need to be doing, and all I keep hearing is, well, let's talk about abortion. Let's talk about stealing elections. Let's talk about nonsense. Get to the business of what needs to be done. Create the damn jobs. Educate people. Now, there are a lot of ways of doing this, Jake. There's an awful lot. I'm a firm believer of direct action. We need roads. We need bridges. Government says we're taking bids. Who's building those roads and bridges? And don't do it on the lowest bidder wins mentality, because then you get shoddy work. Do it on what bid is going to actually put the labor in and is actually going to work out. Because I can underbid anybody. We go in, we do half a job, and go, hey, you know what, didn't work out for us. Now, I got to pick up the slack because of that. But again, it comes back down to jobs. And the Democrats, they've put out a couple of bills. Not going anywhere, because you got Republicans who are going to block it, but they're trying. There's some things I don't like about it. The Georgia plan, not thrilled with. But at the end of the day, they're trying.
Well, what you're talking about is, which way is this administration going to go? Are they going to go to the middle? Are they going to try some of the efforts that were made by previous presidents? Jimmy Carter, maybe some that tended to be in the middle? Or is he going to go FDR? Is he going to go after direct government action, prime the pump, put money into infrastructure, create those jobs? Hopefully that'll prime the pump and get the economy started. There's some who believe he will do that. Can he do that? Is he willing to do that? I would prefer that. I think you would prefer that. It comes down to political will on his part. Does he have the kahunas to do that? I mean, let's be honest. That's going to be politically risky. But I truly do believe that at this point in time, that's what the American people want.
At the end of this, there are so many things we should be doing. Trade deals that actually benefit this country first. The currency manipulation bill that's going through, something that absolutely needs to pass through. And I'm kind of interested to see where the Tea people fall on this. You would think naturally that the Tea Party people would be in favor of holding the Chinese feet to the fire. But it's going to be interesting to see how they vote. It's one thing to have some rhetoric. It's another thing to actually get in there and vote. So I'm kind of interested, because the Tea Party's in a weird spot on this. They've got a base that's saying, well, America first, flag waivers, you know, all of that, which I'm in favor of, wave the flag, but also back it up by action. So it's going to be really interesting to see how some of these votes come down, and we're going to be paying attention to that. Because at the end of the day, if we have balanced trade, we've got a couple million more jobs here in this country, a couple million more people paying taxes into the coffer, a whole bunch more money going back into the system. We're not running as big a deficits, and we're able to do more things. And the more jobs you're able to create, the more your economy expands, the more those things start to happen. And the only way this stuff is going to turn around is by creating those jobs. You know, I was talking to somebody today who's explaining welfare to me. And because he's been doing some research on the history of welfare. And the radical right loves to, you know, to demonize people who collect welfare. And he was saying, you know, in his studies, in his research of this, what he's found is that back during the Roosevelt administration, they didn't want a welfare program. They wanted a jobs program, which is something that I've advocated from the beginning. Look, some unemployment insurance should be 26 weeks. That's it. Anything beyond that, sorry, we're going to find you a job. We're going to get people back to work, because there are therapeutic qualities to work. There's something to be said waking up every day with a goal, every day with something to do. And the same was said for welfare. At the time, they wanted a big jobs program. And personally, I don't think there should be a welfare payment. There should be a paycheck at the end of work. But he was explaining to me that it was the Southern Dixiecrats who pushed so heavily for welfare payments. And now, you know, he couched it in terms of, you know, these Southern Dixiecrats who are the modern day Republicans. Understand, these are the neocons of today. These are the loudest Republicans today. The same ilk. They wanted to make sure that they were able to keep the minorities down, because they didn't want those folks getting uppity, getting those jobs. They didn't want full employment. They liked things the way they were. But they just wanted to make sure that they could dole out to who they wanted to. And it's interesting when you go back and you look at some of the history of this stuff. It's nice to spin it however you want. But at the end of it, most of it comes back down to the conservative mentality, to the current Republican mentality. You could put whatever label you wanted back to it. It still is what it is. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, questions, comments, back after this. But after all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all. Now who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair, sir.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. I want Congress to pass a set of trade deals. Send a message to Congress to come to an agreement on trade deals.
They're selling make believe, and we don't buy that here. 'Cause in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
Well, there are a couple more trade agreements on the horizon: Colombia, South Korea, Panama. The president's been going around talking about it's going to help the economy. We're going to create jobs. And again, you know, I go back to the trade deals of the past. Has it happened? Have we seen massive job growth? Depends on how you look at it. We have seen some jobs created, but we've been a net loser in every one of these trade agreements. And the question is, when you have an ailing economy, over 9% unemployment, can you lose more? Can you afford to lose, you know, and they're talking about the Colombian free trade agreement. It's going to cost us, I think it's like 54,000 jobs was the number I saw. And the South Korean agreement would cost us somewhere in the 159,000 jobs. Still, this is over 200,000 more jobs. Throw that on top of the 15, 16 million people we've got already unemployed. You got a major problem. Now, you know, they're saying, you know, NAFTA cost us some $700,000 jobs and gave us almost $100 billion trade deficit. Again, can we afford more of this? And Harry Reid, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, saying, hey, you know what? Not on my to-do list. In fact, Harry said, you know, I've voted against most trade agreements. He said, I'm not a big fan of free trade. And he said, look at my voting record. Voting record's right there. And he has. He's had a long history of voting against these job-killing trade agreements. He voted no with the Chilean free trade agreement, no with the Singapore trade agreement, no with the Dominican Republic, CAFTA, no there, Oman, Peru, been against them all. And he said, you know, look, and he's got a point. He goes, look, as someone from Nevada, NAFTA hasn't really helped us. You know, and you look at all of those states, they've all been hurt. So when you see someone like Reid saying, you know, I'm not all that interested, and Pelosi's not all that sure where she's going on it either, according to reports. So, you know, I don't know that the will is there so much. And what kind of is interesting, I guess the president's going to have Republicans pushing this stuff through. Kind of weird to me, because no one's been able to show me how these trade agreements are going to make us that much better off. What will make us better off is addressing the problems that we have with the situations we already have. The currency manipulation with China, that is a huge one. And we should be moving on that long before we're talking about how do we pass more of these job-killing free trade agreements. Now, you know, the Democrats, you know, got the trade adjustment assistance passed through. The Republicans in the House are saying, well, you know, when you put those free trade agreements, then we'll maybe talk about it. Like I've been saying, kind of childish, but what do you expect? But here we are talking about these free trade agreements. And I asked the question, why would you have one with a country like Colombia? Why would you have a free trade agreement with a place like Colombia where they throw union people out of planes, where they pull them off of buses and shoot them in the head? Why would you do that? Oh, yeah, that's right. Those are just union people. They're terrorists, according to the radical right wing. And that came out, I don't know if you read The Hill, but there was a story in The Hill talking about how President Rich Trumka of the AFL-CIO sent a letter to the White House saying, look, these are the 22 union leaders who have been killed in Colombia. 15 of them have been killed since we had this labor action plan put into place. And as I'm reading through the comments, it was really the comments that grabbed me by the short hairs and said, hey, there's a problem here. One guy says, you know, this guy talks about workers' rights is enough to make the logical, common sense thinking person ill. Calls him a thug. He's an obvious thug. Another one says, sounds like the Colombians don't like unions either. Another one says, just the opposite in the U.S. Trump and his goons are threatening to kill non-union members. I'm going, I don't remember ever hearing that. Another one says, oh, you know, what do you call 22 dead labor leaders? Oh, a good start, Mr. Tea Party Patriot. And you go down the list, all these people with these euphemistic names for some type of patriotism, you know, they get their venom out, they get their hatred out, and it's, you know, just a whole bunch of nonsense. But again, I don't know that I'm surprised. I mean, you look at the recent debates that the GOP has had. When someone says, well, you know, what about a guy who doesn't have health insurance and he's going to die, and you hear people shouting, let him die? They applaud killing 235 people in Texas because Rick Perry's a good executioner. So I guess now it is that, you know, when you talk about killing labor leaders, I guess the Republicans' response to that is it's a good start. Do they not know the history of this country? Do they not realize that had it not been for workers collectively bargaining, which seems to be the next phrase that they're going to attack, much as they've done the liberal and progressive, collective bargaining will be that four-letter word of the future. Do they not know their history? You know, again, today, 1875, you had people in Fall River, Massachusetts, going on strike for bread, not wages, not benefits, bread to feed their children. That's where we've come from. Do we have to go back to it? I mean, do we have to fight those fights all over again? Do we? I mean, I don't know. Is this where we're heading?
Perhaps we do.
When you see people who obviously do not get it, obviously do not have a clue, they will take the benefits, they will take the gains, they will take the hard-fought fruits of labor and victory without ever saying thank you. It's amazing to me. You know, it takes me back to some of my truck driver friends who, you know, never joined a union, never knew anything about it, who got decent wages, benefits, got decent conditions because the companies they work for didn't want them to organize, who are now looking back as the unionized trucking sector is shrinking, now going, oh, well, they're slashing our wages. The conditions are getting worse. Things are much worse than they've been in the last 5 or 10 years. Saying, oh, gee, I wish the union would organize people again. And I say, the union isn't some outside entity. It's you. What's happened in this country is you've gotten the moneyed interest have figured out how to divorce us from each other, making the union some outside entity other than being a collection of workers who are standing together. They've done a masterful job of divorcing us from our government. It's the government, the evil government, not we the people, not government of, for, and by we the people. It's this evil entity. And they've really done a masterful job. You've got to give them credit on a whole bunch of levels. And maybe it's us. You know, I was reading about the GI Bill and the people who came back from World War II and were thankful to their government for giving them an opportunity that they never really thought they were ever going to have. My grandfather was one of those people who, you know, he learned to drive a truck because somebody gave him a shot. And they had education programs, did the GI Bill, became a mechanic. He did a whole bunch of stuff. Got a whole bunch of education that he never thought possible. Learned to fly a plane. Learned to do an awful lot of things thanks to the GI Bill, which gave him opportunity to make a middle-class living. He knew where that came from. That was because the government gave him an opportunity, our government. What we've done so well is we've blurred the lines between what is of, for, and by we the people and what is of, for, and by they the corporations. To where we no longer look at our government and say, we did that collectively. It's always some other outside entity. It's amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to talk with Laura Clausen in the next segment. She's the labor editor over at the Daily Kos. Today was the Postal Workers Rally Day. We're going to talk a little bit about that, some other stuff. Stick around. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The lockout of union nurses at Sutter Hospitals in California is supposed to end today. Authorities, meanwhile, are investigating the death of a patient at the Alta Bates Summit Medical Center. The patient reportedly died after getting a non-prescribed dosage of a medical drug by one of the replacements hired to fill in when thousands of nurses went on a one-day strike. The nurses were locked out when they tried to return from strike. The California Nurses Association has filed a complaint with the State Department of Public Health. The union says it's concerned that replacements brought in have the certifications and competency to do their jobs. The nurses' union has held candlelight vigils at the hospital, calling on Sutter to end the lockout. The nurses are supposed to be able to return to work today. A new report highlights modern-day slavery in the tobacco fields of the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
A report released last week by the Farm Labor Organizing Committee and Oxfam America exposed a culture in North Carolina of tobacco workers facing near slavery. Findings revealed that 1 in 4 workers are paid less than minimum wage, with a majority saying they don't make enough to meet basic needs. The majority of the workers interviewed for the comprehensive study said they had regular bouts of green tobacco sickness, which comes from absorbing nicotine through the skin. A lack of training and the necessary clothing were both blamed for the reoccurring sickness. North Carolina law requires fresh water to be available for field workers, but the workers said that often isn't the case. Heat stroke is the number one cause of death for farm workers in the state. Workers also face poor living conditions, with most dealing with inadequate plumbing, insect and rodent infestations, worn beds, leaky roofs, and no heat or ventilation. The authors recommend tobacco manufacturers become part of the solution by providing growers with the opportunity to inform pricing. They also recommend a council being created that brings workers, growers, and manufacturers to the same table to make sure growers have the tools for a safe and legal workforce.
Here's a look at the economic numbers game through working class eyes. As the United States endures a possible double-dip recession, the safety net of the unemployed is slowly eroding. Figures from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis show that the amount of money spent on unemployment insurance is in steep decline. Over the past 2 years, payments related to unemployment insurance peaked at $152.8 billion in the first quarter of 2010. In the second quarter of 2011, those payments had dropped to $107.3 billion and are expected to decline into the foreseeable future. This newscast brought to you in part by the United Mine Workers of America. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Surrender is what some of the extremists on the right want to do with the Postal Service. I saw on my Facebook page someone decided to say, well, we should overhaul it and sell it. Well, why overhaul it if you're just going to sell it? I mean, and the thing is, the Postal Service is just fine. If it's not for this bizarre piece of legislation they passed back in 2006 to make them pre-fund their retirement 75 years in the future. I mean, they're pre-funding the retirement of people who aren't even born yet. But again, you know, the idea of that was to destroy it. And, you know, again, conservative mission accomplished. Anyway, here to talk to us about this and a whole bunch of other things is Laura Clausen. She's the labor editor over at Daily Kos. Laura, thanks for taking time for me. So today was the big rally across the country. The postal workers got out to every congressional district. What's your take on this whole postal thing?
As you said, it's a clear right-wing attack on a government agency that's working, and it's working for all of us. It's a huge employer. It gets us the mail and the books and medicines that we need every day, and there's just no reason for it to be under attack like this, except that Republicans are attacking good government in general.
And it's cheap. I mean, you know, somebody was telling me today to ship a letter and, you know, to send a letter in Canada, it's like $1. As we're here, 44 cents.
Right. But, you know, in the U.S., suddenly everything has to turn a profit no matter what.
But the Postal Service is turning a profit. It may not be turning huge profits, but it's operational, if not for this bizarre piece of legislation forcing them to pre-fund their retirement that no other corporation has to do.
Right. And, you know, it's I was thinking about this, and this legislation is that they have to fund their retirement 75 years into the future, right? And when you think about it, this is what attacks on Social Security always say. In 75 years, Social Security may not be liquid anymore. And it's like 75 years seems to be the magic number that they've chosen to attack things as like, well, someday there might be a problem maybe, so we should kill it now.
Yeah, I mean, well, because they're setting it up for you to think about your grandchildren. You know, you won't be around, so you're going to want to make sure that, you know, 100 years from now, things will be taken care of, like you have that kind of control. I find that to be kind of narcissistic, actually.
Yeah, well, and I think it's about 75 years is like, it's your grand, it's not so far in the future that you will have stopped caring. So it's this very carefully chosen kind of horizon.
Yeah, you know, the other thing we're talking about with this, and it's something that I haven't really heard the mainstream media go after. You're talking about some 120,000 jobs, good family-sustaining wage jobs that we cannot afford at this time. When you've got, what, 15, 16 million unemployed right now? Adding another 120 to that, it sounds horrible to me.
Yeah, the Postal Service is actually the second largest civilian employer in the country after Walmart. And I'm just going to go ahead and say that Postal Service jobs are a little bit better than those Walmart jobs are. So that's the scope of what we're seeing under attack here.
Now, you don't see Walmart having to fund their pension 75 years into the future.
What pension?
Exactly. And again, you know, I look at this and I say, is that where conservative world is going to take us?
Absolutely. You know, I've just been reading this book, Retirement Heist, by a Wall Street Journal reporter that's about the ways that corporations have just progressively cut pensions under in all these sneaky ways and used workers' pension money that they earned to fund corporate bottom lines. And I think that's more and more what we're moving toward. Workers work for something that's been promised to them and then gets yanked away and given to corporations.
Well, that's what the 80s, that's what the go-go 80s were with all the Raiders. They would go in, they would snatch up these companies, they would, even companies that were profitable. If they had huge amounts of pensions that they were sitting on, they would rob them blind and cut them off the dime.
Absolutely.
I'll never forget that movie with Danny DeVito, Other People's Money. There was a company that was, you know, they were making a good profit. But it wasn't enough, and they wanted the big payoff, the quick buck, and look what we've done to our country over it.
Exactly.
Now, and Gingrich may be right. Maybe we're a nation of, of food stamps instead of paychecks. And it's all because of policies that his party and a number of Bentney Democrats have pursued over the years. And I look at the numbers, more and more people are collecting food stamps.
More people are collecting food stamps, and more people, that's all they're collecting. That's the only income that they have coming into their households.
I mean, how do you survive on food stamps alone?
I have no idea. I mean, you're looking at an average benefit of less than $300 a month. Some of these people have savings. You know, they're people who were laid off a year or two ago and are just spending down their retirement while food stamps are the only thing they have coming in. But it's unthinkable what that means about people's lives and the fact that there are millions of households in the country where food stamps are all they have coming in.
And on one hand, you go, you know, thank goodness for this safety net program that keeps people from starving and keeps them from utter collapse. But again, it's not enough to really survive on, in my opinion.
No, I can't imagine how you would make nutritional meals for your family off of that kind of money. I mean, that's really living on the least nutritious canned food that you can get and still being hungry all the time.
Yeah, I think
it
takes me back to my youth and the welfare diet. Everything with a noodle, that's what you had because it was cheap and it'd fill you up.
Noodles and, you know, dried beans, pretty much.
You know, it's amazing. And again, I go back to we need a jobs plan. We need, you know, the Republicans in November of 2010 ran on this jobs agenda. I haven't seen anything yet. All I see is division, distraction, and deflection. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, we're talking about rigging the election system so that Republicans can win. We're talking about voter ID stuff so that we can suppress the vote. We're talking about how to take rights from women away for reproductive rights. All the things other than the jobs.
Right. Well, it's they're looking for the next big thing that they can scare people around. That's really the case. And then with all these voter ID and other kinds of voter suppression laws, then how can you keep people from going to polls, or the wrong people, that is, you know, reliably democratic groups of people? How can you just keep them from voting if you can't scare them into voting for you?
Good point. And so if you can't, as I've been saying about this big rig plan that the Republicans here in Pennsylvania want to push through, their ideas fail, their vision fails, their policies fail. So if you can't win fair and square, you got to cheat. So that's what this big rig, this change of 224 years of our history, that's what this is about. It's purely cheating. It's purely an overreach. Theft of our democracy, if you will. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Laura Clausen. She's the labor editor at the Daily Kos. We've got a link at our site at therickssmithshow.com. You know, to me, education is the key, and you've written an interesting piece on part-time college students. And I got to be honest, I was shocked at the low rates of graduation by part-time students.
Well, one of the big things is that nobody's really been tracking this. So it's something that I think a lot of us are shocked by, just because the numbers weren't out there. You know, when you have part-time students, what that mostly says is that they're people who have a lot of other things going on in their lives. They have families, they have to work to support themselves, and then you have skyrocketing tuition and people who just can't keep up with it.
And the thing about the tuition is once you incur that, it doesn't go away. I mean, you can't default on it. It just keeps building over your head.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's kind of keeping inequality in this country, is that if you have parents who can pay for you to go to college, then you're coming out without debt and you have this big leg up. And if you're someone whose family can't afford to pay for you, it just, you're starting off your adult life in this enormous hole.
It's amazing. And, you know, the thing is, I go back to a friend of mine who, she's, you know, about 15, 20 years older than I am, back in the late 60s, graduated from the University of Michigan, and the University of Michigan's law school, with no debt coming out of college. She was able to pay her own way working a minimum wage job, because our government funded education back then. Now it seems to be, well, we've shifted the responsibility from we the people to, well, you poor schlub, you're going to have to take out loans.
Right, and you're seeing even things like state schools, where in-state tuition is supposed to be kind of the good deal in education. A lot of them are starting to recruit more students from out of state to get those out-of-state tuitions, which means that there are less spots available for kids from in the state to get a semi-affordable education. And even with that, state school tuition has gone up a lot in recent years.
Did you see, and to me, at the end of this, it's really about jobs as well. You need, when these kids are getting out of college, you have to have somewhere to put them. There has to be somewhere to go, which is why I got to be honest. I think what's going on in New York, it could be the start of something really interesting, as the Occupy Wall Street people are showing the angst of that generation, much like, you know, during Vietnam, when the kids started being lotteried into the draft, they took attention and said, hey, we're not putting up with it anymore.
Right. Just seeing people willing to get out into the streets is a big change in recent months. I mean, we really saw it first in Wisconsin, but this, I think, kind of keeps that ball rolling, that it's not just about, you know, going out and marching around for a little while. It's about sustained disruption of daily life, and that's what it takes to change things.
Yeah, and seeing on the evening news how the cops are throwing people around and pepper spraying them and the abuse that goes on there.
Right, and I think there's, on the one hand, a kind of willingness to write it off as stuff that's being done to dirty hippies, but on the other hand, if it happens to enough people's kids and enough people are going home and talking about it, that has the potential to build a movement.
Yeah, but dirty hippies don't usually fight back. They're pretty passive generally. So it's not an awful lot to beat up some hippie.
Right. Takes a lot of bravery.
Yeah. Well, again, did you see this story? And I don't know if you saw it in the Hill. Trump had sent a letter to Obama saying, hey, there were 22 labor leaders killed. 15 of them since the labor agreement that you agreed to, and all of the comments that came out after it, well, 22 dead labor leaders, that's a good start. Is this really the direction our country is heading?
Well, it's definitely the direction a certain segment of our country is heading, and, you know, often I think newspaper on the comment sections are just the worst of the worst cesspools of that kind of stuff. And it's representing something real that's out there that's just kind of, let's get anyone out of our way who might stand in the way of capital taking over completely.
Yeah, and I look at this, and I got to be honest, it's scary to me that there's this mentality. You go back to the, as I talked about earlier, you go back to the Republican debates. They're talking about somebody dying. You got people in the crowd screaming, "Let them die!" They cheer when they talk about Rick Perry executing people. It's a really bizarre concept to me.
Yeah, it's really mind-boggling that this is where a politically powerful part of our country is right now, is this just kind of mean-spirited, petty bloodlust.
What do you think of these three trade agreements? I mean, I got to be honest, I think they're horrible. I think they're going to kill more jobs in this country and cost us more down the road. Curious your thoughts.
I'm in the same place. I think that without serious labor protections being built into them, which, as we see, are not working in Colombia. There was this labor agreement, and we've seen, you know, all 15 union leaders killed since then. Without something with a whole lot more teeth, what we're going to see is jobs keep going overseas and working conditions for workers in those countries just continuing to be driven down through not just intimidation, but actual murder.
Yeah, I mean, if we allow the jobs to leave here to go to places that are going to exploit people like that, eventually it pulls us down too. And that's the thing that I try to get across to folks. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, the Chinese are working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, and hey, too bad for them. That's pulling us down as well. In order for us to compete, we've got to be willing to do that as well.
Right, and that's what I think the end game is. That's why you hear people like Michelle Bachmann talking about how the minimum wage is bad for our economy and other things like that from prominent Republican voices.
Yeah, I love Michelle Bachmann. But then again, I've always been a fan of crazy. Laura Clausen, I appreciate the time. Labor editor over at Daily Kos. We've got a link to their site over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Laura's name. Always great talking to you. Look forward to seeing you again next week.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And then there were 12. When the 435 House members and 100 senators failed in July to agree on a long-term deficit reduction plan, the leaders did what they often do when they don't know what to do. They appointed a committee. But don't sneer, for this is, cue the trumpets, a super committee. Made up of only a dozen lawmakers and perfectly balanced between Repubs and Dems, this panel is to find about $1.5 trillion in spending cuts and new revenues to shrink the federal deficit. The theory is that the group will be small enough to work together across partisan lines for the good of the country, independent of the competing budgetary needs of various groups and the demands of special interests. The problem with theories is that reality has a way of intruding on their perfection. In this case, the intrusion is literal. The 12 Solons will not be sitting at the table alone, for such names as AT&T, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Citigroup, and GE have been escorted inside by the members. They'll not go in physically, but monetarily, for they are among the top donors of campaign cash to the 12 budgeteers, giving them an advantage over us plain citizens. For example, Wall Streeters have invested $17 million in the campaigns of the Super Committee's 6 Republicans and $15 million in the 6 Democrats. That pile of political money will be a screaming presence in the negotiating room, for members will be thinking about their need to get more of it for the next election and will not want to offend donors. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, one of the first decisions reached by the committee members was that they would allow themselves to continue collecting campaign donations while they decide whose programs and subsidies get cut and whose don't. How do you think that's going to work out?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So you remember last week we talked to the woman from the California Nurses Association. You know, how 23,000 of these nurses said, you know what, we need to get the company's attention. We need to jumpstart the negotiations. The company just stonewalled. You'll get what we're offering, and that's it. Really kind of highlighting the fractured nature of our collective bargaining structure here and the fractured nature of our labor laws. So they went out on a one-day strike, and then the next day they were going to go back. Company said, no, sorry. We're going to lock you out. So during this lockout, Judith Ming, 66, they say died. I'm saying was killed by a scab replacement nurse who they say was 100% credentialed. They pulled her from somewhere in Alabama to come to California to work in this hospital. And what she did, you figure out what you want. She put this nutritional supplement directly into this woman's bloodstream when she should have inserted it into a catheter in her stomach. So it went right into her bloodstream instead of into her stomach, because it's a nutritional supplement, supposed to keep her alive, supposed to keep her, the nutrients and everything in her body, because she's fighting ovarian cancer, fighting for her life, goes through all of that stuff, ends up being killed by a nurse who did the wrong thing, a replacement nurse. And again, I keep going back, and the blame games being, back and forth. The hospital's trying to blame it on the workers, and accidents happen, kind of thing, is what the hospital's also saying. But the reality is, when you have these qualified people who do this job day in, day out, know the patients, know the scenario, you don't have these problems. Or at least not in this case. So shame on this hospital system, and shame on these people. And again, it goes back to our fractured labor laws. Insane. You want to talk about business power? You want to talk about how powerful the corporate America is? Back during NAFTA, we were supposed to open the Mexican border, allowing Mexican domiciled trucks to come rolling here into the U.S. Well, the Clinton administration stopped it, said, no, don't think so. The Bush administration for a while said no, tried to set up a pilot program. That got shot down because it was a horrible failure. So the Mexicans decided, you know what, we're going to slap some tariffs on certain items strategically placed, the power centers of American politics, agriculture, wine, grapes and potatoes and, cotton, all the agricultural stuff and some other stuff, $92 billion worth of tariffs. And that made the Chamber of Commerce and all of the business elites squeal. So they put enormous pressure on the Obama administration, and he said, all right, let's open up the border, and we'll pay for the drug testing, and we'll pay for the licensing, and we'll pay for the electronic onboard recorders, and we'll pay to to track them, we'll pay to do all this stuff. And even beyond all this, the Department of Transportation is concerned, because there's a little thing in there that says, in Section 350 of the Transportation Appropriation Act of 2001, little something in there that mandates that you have the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration do half of their pre-authorization audits in Mexico. Well, the country is really in the midst of a war.
And they don't know that they're going to be able to find people to go into Mexico and do these audits that are required by law. Because they're saying, you know, we don't want to send our people into a war zone. We can't protect them. And, you know, you look at this program, and to me, it's more of this importing of cheap labor. We don't have to outsource jobs anymore because we don't have many jobs to outsource left. So now we're going to import workers. And what this has been dubbed is the guest worker program on wheels. So you're going to have a whole bunch of guest workers driving around here in the U.S. And at a time when unemployment's over 9%, I'd love to hear my truck driver friends, their take on this. At this time, do you really want to create an environment where we're going to lose more jobs? Because I really don't see American drivers willing to take their shiny bumpers into Mexico. I just, sorry, not getting it. Especially into a war zone where, you know what? If the federales don't get you, the drug cartels will. But at the end of this, you know, you got to look at this and say, this is big business exerting their pressure. They've got us. They've got us. They're holding them in their hands and they're squeezing because we need them. Or at least they've convinced us that we need them. So we can't regulate them. We can't make sure that they do in the interest of what's all of our interest. We've got to pander to their special interest. And what I find interesting, you look at some of the numbers that have been going on. DOT has been trying to do some inspection numbers and trying to look at things. In the trucks coming across the border in Texas, the inspectors there in Texas found some 1.2 million safety violations between 2007 and 2011. That is just Texas. That's not the rest of them. So I keep going back to this. We're going to fund all of this. The onboard recorders, the drug testing, the licensing, all of this. We're going to fund it all. It's going to cost us, I would say, at least tens of thousands of jobs on the very, very short term. That's not saying how many warehouse jobs we're going to lose. That's not saying how many ancillary jobs we're going to end up losing because of all of that giant sucking sound down into Mexico that Ross Perot was talking about. And this is sucking sound number two. I just go, at some point, don't we have to wake up and fight back? I'm amazed that we've allowed the business interests to have this kind of power over us. I'm just amazed by it. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances.
Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing Life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like, don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
Well, today they were standing in the welfare lines, something that I hope someone took some pictures of, kind of the image that I've been waiting to see. I mean, we've done such a masterful job of putting the unemployed in dark corners and the homeless in dark corners that we never have that visual. Amazing stuff. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK is the number. Last night I talked a little bit about the report released by the National Law Center on homelessness and poverty. And it showed that housing homeless families was actually more cost-effective than just providing the federally mandated transportation for these homeless students. And, of course, the report is called Beds Not Buses, Housing versus Transportation for Homeless Students. And it reported that the number of homeless students in the country has risen a staggering 20% since the beginning of this recession. More than a million homeless kids. That's just mind-boggling to me. And here to help us work through this, talk a little bit about it, is Eric Tarz. He is the Children's Rights Director at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. They're the folks who've put out the report. Eric, thanks for taking time for me.
Happy to be here.
Right, I guess the first thing I have to say is, you know, the sheer fact that a study has to be done tells me we've really got a long way to go as a society, because to me this should be just a matter of common sense.
Absolutely. I mean, we at the National Law Center believe that housing is a basic human right that everybody should be entitled to, just as a matter of their, you know, basic human dignity. And in fact, the American people agree. There's studies have shown that over 70% of Americans believe that everybody should be entitled to housing, and that everybody should be entitled to basic education. And so this is kind of just putting the two and two together, saying, you know, if we as Americans really have that as a value, that we believe every person should have housing and should have access to education, why are we spending this money that could be better spent on housing a whole family, rather than simply providing transportation to the kids to make sure that they have stability in their education?
Yeah, I look at this and I ask the question, are these kids ready to learn when they really, you know, how can they be ready to learn when they don't know where they're going to put their head that night, let alone where they're going to do their homework?
Exactly. That's the biggest challenge. And that's why the transportation that is provided at this point is so important, because as these kids are going through just these tremendous upheavals in their life, if they can have one stable thing in their life, that being school, at least they have that. At least they have the consistency of their friends and their teachers, whereas if they're not only having to deal with moving from place to place every night, but also having to change schools, then obviously that's going to set them back hugely in their education, and then that's going to have lifelong consequences and, you know, perhaps even perpetuate a cycle of homelessness for them in the future.
Yeah, and, you know, due to this recession and all of the job losses and all of the foreclosures, the number of homeless folks, I mean, just in walking around the city of Harrisburg here, has, in my opinion, gone up exponentially. Just from looking around, I can't imagine, what a place like Philadelphia or some major cities, what kind of situations they have there.
Absolutely. And the folks that who you see on the street are just the tip of the iceberg. We see the data that's been collected over the past 6 years on the homeless education program has shown that 60 to 70% of the homeless students who are identified are living in doubled-up situations. They're living with family or friends in temporary situations, bunking on couches, or living in motels or hotels. So they aren't on the streets. You might not see them necessarily if you weren't looking closely, if you didn't see that they're wearing the same clothes every day at school, or they skip lunches now and then. But, so the folks that you see on the street, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
You know, a couple of years ago during one of our food drives, because we do a food drive every couple of years for the local food bank, and a family came up looking, asking us how to get some assistance, and they were just a young couple with a daughter, same age as my daughter, and the kids sat and played, and I remember feeling I can't imagine from a parental position imagining having my child be homeless like that, because these three folks were living in their car.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the reality that we are seeing for more and more families. They, in many cases, are working but have just had one medical setback that they aren't insured. They're working poor. They are making minimum wage at some job that doesn't offer health care, and all of a sudden they can't make their mortgage payment or their rent payment, and so instead of being housed and just barely making ends meet, all of a sudden they're homeless and they just can't save up that extra amount for the first month's deposit or the down payment, certainly, and then they're just kind of stuck there. So we definitely need a huge rethinking of how we approach housing if we really want to guarantee housing to everybody and have the opportunity. It's not that it has to be public housing for everybody or Section 8 vouchers. There's a lot that we can do in terms of rent stabilization or incentives for private developers to create more affordable housing, or simply preventing homelessness in the first place by giving families access to rental assistance or mortgage assistance to just get them over that hump so that they don't lose their home, but they're able to stay in their home and they're able to maintain their community connection and continue to be productive members of the community.
Right. We just talked to a woman earlier in the program who was here in Harrisburg talking about the HEMAP program that the governor and the Republicans here in the state of Pennsylvania decided, we don't need anymore. And she talked about how it saved her from losing her home and ultimately being homeless herself. And it's those kind of programs, smart policy that keeps people in their homes, that I think we need to be pursuing more often. But let's get to the numbers in this, because some staggering numbers. What does it cost a school district to have to transport a child that's homeless? What kind of ballpark numbers?
Well, so the study that we were working from was a 2006 study in the state of Washington.
All right. Well, the numbers that I looked at put it somewhere in the average of $18,000 to $27,000 a year. That was on average, and this is, their numbers. And to get people into local housing, their numbers are saying somewhere in $12,000 a year. So, I mean, there are massive savings. There's an opportunity there to keep families together and, give people the opportunity, a chance, really, to have a future. And that's what we should be really working on. I got Eric Tarz back on the line, dropped off a second. Eric, thanks for calling back.
No problem.
So the numbers, and I just went through them. Your report saying the transportation costs somewhere between $18,000 to $27,000. That seems to be really high.
Often what we see, in some big cities it can be less if there's public transportation available. But especially in suburban or rural districts, often when a family has to move, it's across district lines. And if they have to be transported, just one or two students, by a whole school bus or by some private car or even gas reimbursement to the family, those costs, if there's 180 days in the school year, each day they have to go two ways, so that's 360 trips a year. And the cost, it can be anywhere from $3 to $50 a day to transport a student. So those costs just multiply. And yeah, by the end of the year, you can see these costs running into the tens of thousands of dollars. And when you compare that to the cost of providing a Section 8 voucher, which is anywhere from $9,000 to $12,000 a year for a one- or two-bedroom apartment, you know, that you could be saving anywhere from 40 to 100 and something percent just by, and that provides a whole family with housing, a whole family with stability, rather than just simply shuttling a child back and forth.
And how is it that this transportation thing came to be? Because I would assume if, you know, since I didn't know, I would assume that if you're going to move wherever it is that you put up stakes is where you would end up sending your kids to school, but evidently not. I mean, it's the home district. I guess you can't really register someone if you don't have an address, really, right?
Well, no, you can. So the McKinney-Vento Act, which is a major federal legislation dealing with homelessness, offers two possibilities to homeless students. And the act comes out of research showing that the most important thing to maintain a child's educational progress is stability, that if they change schools, that they are going to lose about 6 months of education each time, and that if they change schools multiple times, then it can cut their rates of graduation by 50% or more. So coming out of this, Congress said, we need to make sure that homeless kids are able to have some stability and continuity in their education. So they can either, when they move, say, from District A to District B, through the course of their homelessness, they can either register immediately in District B and have, they don't have to fill out all the paperwork, they don't have to have their immunization records or, you know, a permanent residence, obviously, they can get immediately enrolled in their new district. However, because the research has shown that it's far better for the child to maintain those connections with their teachers, with their peers, and that's what's going to keep them in school, engaged, and learning, the preference in the law is to keep them in their school of origin. And in order to facilitate that, the district has to figure out how they are going to transport the student back. As long as it's in the child's best interest. If the child moves, you know, 50 miles away and it's going to be hour-long bus ride, that's probably not going to be in the child's best interest. Although if it's a senior and he's got 3 months to graduation and he can drive himself or he doesn't mind a long bus ride, then, you know, that would be in the child's best interest. But if it's an elementary student, then it's probably going to make more sense for them to register in the new district.
But at the end of the day, when you look at the costs, I mean, I would much prefer people having a roof over their head than transportation back and forth.
Exactly. And the problem that we're seeing is that, you know, obviously schools and the homeless liaisons, the law also requires a liaison for each school district to be familiar with the law, and they're supposed to be working with their partners in the community. Schools don't control the local housing policy. So even if they would like to provide homes for these families and keep them stable and keep them in the district, they can't do that. What we need is a partnership between the schools, and we need community members. We need school boards. We need zoning commissions. We need, city councils, county boards of supervisors to understand that these costs affect everybody. As a local taxpayer, you have to pay your school taxes, you have to pay your city or county taxes, and you could either be paying tens of thousands of dollars for transportation or for housing. So you have to look at what the whole community, the cost of the whole community is, and what the benefit could be from simply making sure those affordable housing policies are in place.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it comes down to policy. It comes down to smart investment. I could go on an hour-long rant about the failures of our government lately. But I look at this, and I see all these homeless people on the streets, and I want to help. And I think every person who walks by wants to help. But this isn't something that an individual can do. This is something we have to do as a society and decide that, look, you know, no one should be homeless unless they really want to be, but no one should have to be.
Right, and, you know, for the vast majority of people, nobody chooses to be homeless. And this isn't a red or a blue issue, a conservative or a progressive issue, the McKinney-Vento Act, the primary sponsor of it, Stuart McKinney, was a Republican because he believed that in this kind of problem. And, you know, if you're a fiscal conservative, this report shows that the fiscally smart thing to do is to provide.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be through direct subsidies to the families. It can be through market regulation. And, you know, I know that regulation isn't always popular, but we regulate the housing market every day. We create these incentives for developers to provide luxury condos or build large McMansions. We should say, in exchange for some of these tax breaks and other incentives we're giving you, you know, you should also have to build, you know, set aside 10% of your units as affordable units. And just that sort of policy would create the affordable housing that communities desperately need.
I agree. And the report is called Beds, Not Buses, Housing versus Transportation for Homeless Students. We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com. Eric, I appreciate you taking time for us tonight, telling us about this. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Eric Tarz, the Children's Rights Director at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Again, Beds, Not Buses. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much, Eric. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Yes, like groceries and our haters. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of the program there, you can download the podcast from our website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program wherever you go. Good stuff right there. Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher. That's the way to go.
I honestly, you know, there are times where you go, I honestly cannot believe this is really happening. Goldman Sachs, who is an extremely profitable enterprise, they're going to plan on cutting $1.2 billion in costs in the next year, I guess. They're talking about laying off some 1,000 of their employees. At the same time, when you see Goldman along with their other banking cohorts over at Citigroup or J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America setting aside over $65 billion to cover their bonuses and their benefits and everything, an increase of 8% last year, setting aside a boatload of money and cutting 1,000 jobs. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point we're going to have to realize that corporate America, not our friends. These aren't the people who are our saviors. Wall Street is not the savior. Lloyd Blankenfein may think he's doing God's work. He's not. All he's doing is downsizing not only his workforce, but evidently downsizing the drinking cups that they put next to the water cooler. I guess no longer can the employees there have 12-ounce drinking cups. Evidently, that's out of the budget. Absolutely insane. And we've got a political party who is hell-bent on being more business-friendly. How much more can we give to the investor class? And again, I look at Chris Christie and I say, you know, he's probably a guy who, as green as he is, could possibly give Obama the best run of the people out there. I still think he's going to jump in. We'll see. He has said he's not going to, but I keep saying they wave enough of that green stuff under his nose, he'll jump at it. And how can you not, given the people that you run against, you'd be running against? I mean, look at Michelle Bachmann, and I talked about this last night. She honestly said she's afraid that Hezbollah is going to put missile sites in Cuba. Really? I mean, they, I think, would be one of the last concerns that we have. But again, I guess, you know, she really has this in her head that I fear what's in her head. The fact that she sees that as a major possibility of a threat, that kind of worries me. Doesn't it worry you? I mean, doesn't that worry you that you've got this woman who really, honestly and truthfully believes that, oh, you know, we can't deal with Cuba. We can't have a trade agreement with them. We can't work with them. They might let Hezbollah put training camps there. Nuts.
Well, she says things like that, and then you have the governor of Texas who's imploded. And you might have, you know, you might have a legitimate point, Rick. I think maybe out of desperation they were going to the governor of New Jersey and say, what do you need? We'll give you anything you want to run. That could be an eventuality. And then you have the ex-governor of Massachusetts, Romney, who purely and simply can't get elected because of the conservative swing of the Republican Party. So the Republicans have some real, real problems out there. And I think the power brokers behind the scenes are getting worried.
Yep. Well, Newt Gingrich picked up a major endorsement. He picked up the endorsement of a guy named Judson Phillips. He is the founder of Tea Party Nation. In fact, Phillips wrote on his blog, first, talking about the Newtster, first he's a conservative, perhaps not as conservative as some would like, but remember, no candidate is perfect. He says that Newt is electable. Yeah, good luck on that. If you have seen the GOP debates, Gingrich is the best debater. He does really well in that format, and he looks presidential. And I can just see the new Gingrich bumper sticker. Newt, the master debater. I can see that. But, you know, again, I personally don't think the Newtster's electable. Again, another loser. Too much baggage, too many skeletons in the closet, and really kind of just a snot. I mean, really,
too much jewelry.
Too much bling.
Too much bling bling with his wife.
All right, well, there you go. Can you imagine her first lady?
No.
Wow. God bless us. Help.
No,
help.
I can't, help. Actually.
But, you know, then again, you go to the guy who came off the big win in Florida, the Herman Cain train. Herman's got his, he just, again, released, they're saying just released, again just released, his $9.99 plan. Kind of reminds me of the Earl Scheib. You know who Earl Scheib was?
Yes, he was. We used to get, what, $29.95 paint job?
I'll paint any car, any color, $29.99.
Oh, baby, that'll take about 2 minutes to do.
Yeah, and they would paint your car.
Yeah.
If you didn't tape off the bumpers, they painted the bumper. Right.
They painted everything.
But windows, everything. If you didn't tape it off, they painted it.
I still remember those commercials.
But his $9.99 plan. Going to go into effect immediately, according to the Kermit Cain train. Never mind that you're going to have to deal with Congress on this, and good luck figuring that one out. But he wants, you know, 9% tax on businesses, 9% tax on individuals, and a 9% sales tax. So, again, all you poor people, all of us working stiffs, that is an increase in your taxes.
Is that his version of the fair tax?
Yeah. And again, I don't know how the math works out.
I don't see how that's enough income.
It's not. And that's the point. It goes back to the star of the beast. It goes back to the, if we can take enough money out of government, we can just destroy it. A good CEO move, and you got to give him credit. He's one of the guys who was a CEO, and he understands if we can just let business run the world, we can profit from it. And, you know, I guess if I were a CEO, I would want the same thing. But now it's not only bad enough that he wants this $9.99 plan. He wants to put a requirement in that you have to have two-thirds votes in the Senate before you can change his $9.99 plan. And we know in places that have this two-thirds vote that taxes never get increased. And, again, that's the point. Like California. California's got some major problems because of this. And that seems to be what the right wants. They want to make it so that we're incapable of dealing with problems at all. And that we then have to rely on private for-profit interests to come to our rescue. And it's amazing to me. But again, that is their worldview. And I respect people who will make the argument and stand up for it. I have a problem with people who don't understand it. So if you're voting for these people, they have a worldview that nothing is ours. Nothing belongs to we the people. Everything is private. And you pay for every service, everything you get, everywhere you go, every time you leave your house, every time you cross the road, every time you go through a red light, you're paying. That's conservative world. And those who are the very wealthy get to keep the vast majority. It's just amazing stuff. Do you remember when they had the debate where everyone raised their hand if they could trade 10% or 10 cuts for every $1 of budget of revenue? Everyone raised their hand. A 10-to-1 ratio of spending cuts to revenue increases. Everybody raised their hand. Well, evidently Mitch Daniels has now decided to weigh in. Can I be the first to say it's kind of late? Because he said, you know, if I were standing on the stage, I would not have raised my hand. That's easy to say. What is it? We're a month out now, month and a half, two. Way to be on top of the game there, Mitch. And he's another guy. You never know. I mean, they've been, you know, trying to court him a little bit. I don't see it. But again, you know, that's what they're going after. Tricky Ricky was on Ed Schultz's show, I guess it was last night, right? You watched, right?
I didn't see him, to be honest.
Okay, well, Tricky Ricky was on the Schultz show and pulled the right-wing frame about the housing collapse, said it was caused by regulation. And, you know, truth, honesty, reality, never mind. Tricky Ricky said, no, it wasn't deregulation. It wasn't deregulation at all. Part of it was government regulation and government markets that caused the bubble burst. When the reality is over 80% of the mortgages, of the subprime mortgages, were private lenders. Back after this.
The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The lockout of union nurses at Sutter Hospitals in California is supposed to end today. Authorities, meanwhile, are investigating the death of a patient at the Alta Bates Summit Medical Center. The patient reportedly died after getting a non-prescribed dosage of a medical drug by one of the replacements hired to fill in when thousands of nurses went on a one-day strike. The nurses were locked out when they tried to return from strike. The California Nurses Association has filed a complaint with the State Department of Public Health. The union says it's concerned that replacements brought in have the certifications and competency to do their jobs. The nurses' union has held candlelight vigils at the hospital, calling on Sutter to end the lockout. The nurses are supposed to be able to return to work today. A new report highlights modern-day slavery in the tobacco fields of the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
A report released last week by the Farm Labor Organizing Committee and Oxfam America exposed a culture in North Carolina of tobacco workers facing near slavery. Findings revealed that 1 in 4 workers are paid less than minimum wage, with a majority saying they don't make enough to meet basic needs. The majority of the workers interviewed for the comprehensive study said they had regular bouts of green tobacco sickness, which comes from absorbing nicotine through the skin. A lack of training and the necessary clothing were both blamed for the reoccurring sickness. North Carolina law requires fresh water to be available for field workers, but the workers said that often isn't the case. Heat stroke is the number one cause of death for farm workers in the state. Workers also face poor living conditions, with most dealing with inadequate plumbing, insect and rodent infestations, worn beds, leaky roofs, and no heat or ventilation. The authors recommend tobacco manufacturers become part of the solution by providing growers with the opportunity to inform pricing. They also recommend a council being created that brings workers, growers, and manufacturers to the same table to make sure growers have the tools for a safe and legal workforce.
Here's a look at the economic numbers game through working class eyes. As the United States endures a possible double-dip recession, the safety net for the unemployed is slowly eroding. Figures from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis show that the amount of money spent on unemployment insurance is in steep decline. Over the past 2 years, payments related to unemployment insurance peaked at $152.8 billion in the first quarter of 2010. In the second quarter of 2011, those payments had dropped to $107.3 billion and are expected to decline into the foreseeable future. This newscast brought to you in part by the United Mine Workers of America. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
You know, don't forget Boeing. Boeing's one of the nations of the world now. And if you remember last night, we talked about the hand delivery of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner to All Nippon Airways head as the Boeing employees literally pulled the plane by hand and hand delivered it to the All-Nippon Airways head. And along with this hand delivery came a very nice bow in unison, all of the employees all together, sign of respect for the Japanese head. Very, very, I guess I would like to have seen it. And while this was going on, we're learning more and more about what the Boeing executives did, and in fact that they did indeed conspire to retaliate against the very workers who built with their hands and delivered with those same hands this 787. And since they had the audacity to stand up for themselves, well, this is what we get. That's why I've asked John Logan, director and professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, to come talk to his about his piece, Labor Woes Make Dreamliner Delivery a Bittersweet Celebration for Boeing. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be here. Thank you for helping me.
You know, I look at this story, and again, we've been talking about it for some time. The reality is what it is. Boeing retaliated against their workers because they went on strike. Period. Bottom line. Simple thing.
Right. Yeah. And I think in the last week, we've received a lot more evidence to reinforce that fact. I mean, this dates back to April when the acting general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, Leif Solomon, issued a complaint against Boeing, alleging that the company had relocated production from Everett in Washington State to South Carolina in retaliation for legal strike action by the unionized Boeing workers in Washington State. A Boeing executive had been interviewed by the Seattle Times on an online televised online interview and said that the overriding factor for choosing South Carolina was not the wages, was not the business climate, but was the desire to avoid further strike action. Now, under the law, that's illegal. Boeing has subsequently denied that that was the reason it chose South Carolina over Washington State. It said it was to do with economic factors. But as a result of the court case, ongoing court case in Seattle at the moment, the administrative law judge is hearing the case, documents have emerged. A presentation that was given to the Boeing board in 2009, titled Project Gemini, which once again clearly states that the primary reason that they were taking this decision was because they wanted to get the upper hand over the machinist union, and they wanted to make sure they wouldn't have to deal with unions, collective bargaining, and strikes. And these documents say explicitly that that South Carolina was a more expensive option, that it was an option that was, by the company's own analysis, the most likely to fail. So it wasn't the prudent economic decision. The assembly plant in Washington State is extremely efficient, extremely productive. This was retaliation against the union.
Absolutely. And, you know, you look at the numbers, and they were saying that it was going to be a significant greater expense, because what they had to do in South Carolina is clear swampland and then be able to build on swampland. And also they said that the backload of the 787s that they had, the backlog, they were going to reduce their earnings by a third. And I'm going, you know, one, why would you move all the way to the other side of the country away from where your knowledge base is, set up something completely untested, completely void of any knowledge capital, if it weren't for retaliating against these workers?
Right. And that's very much the language that they use. They talk about reducing the union dependence and the rebalancing an unbalanced and uncompetitive labor relationship. There's really no way to interpret the things that they say in this presentation other than a desire to flee the union. And clearly, you know, as I said, it's not on the basis of an economic analysis of what's going to be the most profitable, most efficient, most productive assembly location, but it's because they don't want to have to deal with the machinist union. They don't want to have to deal with the threat of future strike actions. So under the National Labor Relations Act, Boeing can choose to move production from Washington State to South Carolina for economic reasons, but it can't move production in retaliation for exercising a protected right, such as the right of legal strike action, which was the case here. So, again, it really makes a nonsense of Boeing's repeated denials that this was nothing to do with its desire to avoid the union and to avoid strikes. And I think Boeing, you know, it's very clear that the company knows that it's legally on very thin ground, that it has a very, very weak legal argument. And so instead of actually allowing this case to go through the proper process, it's decided to try and fight it in the political realm and to use its very willing allies in the Republican Party in Congress amongst the GOP presidential hopefuls to pillory and to demonize the National Labor Relations Board for daring to enforce the law.
Yeah, I mean, and the bigger question in this to me is, you know, Boeing's one situation, but this kind of stuff happens quite frequently.
Sure. So in this country, do workers have the right to withhold their labor in those situations and not be retaliated against?
Right. And, you know, and I think we see this very, very clearly in you know, the declining strike levels. I mean, the levels of major strikes fallen to you know, virtually insignificant levels. You're talking about, you know, like fewer than 20 strikes per year involving 1,000 or more workers, which, you know, in a workforce of over 140 million is really kind of astounding. And this has fallen from several hundred per year in the 1970s. Now, of course, you know, no one particularly wants to see strikes. I mean, we would much rather see cooperative labor relations in which everyone is doing well. But the reason that strikes have fallen so dramatically in this country is that, you know, workers well know that, you know, going out and strike can be a virtually suicidal act, and that there will be retaliation, and that, you know, that if they don't lose their jobs immediately, they may, as in the case of the Boeing workers here, suffer collectively at some later date.
You know, I look at this, and you're right on the strike front. Most of the things that we see are lockouts.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and if you see what's happened with strikes, it's obviously a combination of factors, the very weak protection for strikes, and the fact that, you know, that for going out on economic strikes, the workers can be permanently replaced, cannot be fired, but can be permanently replaced. And also because, of course, new management has been on this all-out offensive against unions and collective bargaining for the past three or four decades, and has taken full advantage of every opportunity to use strikes as a weapon against unions. But as you said, I mean, the legal issues here are relatively straightforward. I mean, of course, the case is unusual because it involves Boeing, and because of the sort of the political uproar and political controversy that's resulted from the case. But in terms of the application of the law, it's actually a relatively straightforward case. And the reason that the labor board is being criticized relentlessly by the Republicans, and you know, we've had bills passed in the House to remove the ability to order the reversal of relocation decisions, even if they're taken for unlawful reasons. The reason that we've seen all of this is simply that the board is daring to do its job to try to enforce the law.
Now, how dare they? How dare they do their job? I mean, it's been years. There's part of me that feels sorry for Boeing, because they've been getting away with this stuff for, and corporate America has been getting away with this stuff for so many years that the Labor Relations Board was basically toothless. They were actually used against workers and for corporations, and they were used to that. And now it's actually doing what it's supposed to. They don't know how to act.
And I think that's clearly part of it, that, you know, the company is really incredulous that, you know, the NLRB would actually have the audacity to dare to try and, you know, enforce the law against Boeing, that to say that, you know, Boeing has to obey the law just as everyone else has to obey the law. And, you know, this, you know, it clearly didn't come as a surprise to Boeing when Boeing made the decision in 2009 and then started the construction of the North Charleston, South Carolina plant in 2010, which has just recently been completed, the $750 million plant in South Carolina. It was put on notice in 2010 when it started by the Machinist Union that, you know, that this was an illegal action, and the Machinist Union would be filing a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. So none of this is a surprise to Boeing. Boeing knew exactly what it was doing, and Boeing knew exactly what was going on, and Boeing should have known exactly what the outcome would have been. But as you say, I mean, probably believed that, you know, since it is Boeing, then it doesn't have to abide by the rules the same way that everyone else does.
Yeah. Again, the piece is Labor Woes Make Dreamliner Delivery a Bittersweet Celebration for Boeing, written by our friend John Logan, director and professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University's. So last question I've got, you know, as we're moving down this process, is there any opportunity for negotiation, do you think? Because early on I had heard there might be some compromise.
Right. Well, I mean, the Machinist Union, I think, is very, very willing to compromise. And in fact, we'd like a compromise because really it's in the interest of neither party for this to last for years. And you know, Boeing has stated its intention to appeal all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. But really, you know, the parties could come to an agreement very, very quickly that would not even involve the transfer of that work back from South Carolina to Washington State. The machinists would be perfectly happy to allow that work to go ahead in South Carolina, I'm sure, for the guarantee of future work to be located in Everett in Washington State, and has reached out to the company, tried to reach that kind of deal. It's clearly in the interest of both parties. For the time being, for some reason, Boeing has rejected that, seems to believe that ultimately it will prevail in the courts no matter what, and you know, seems to be set on this path of confrontation. Now, I hope that won't be the case, and I hope that there will be a sensible settlement that actually benefits both parties. But, of course, beyond that, there's the political issue that we saw Mitt Romney writing an op-ed criticizing the NLRB again over this case in the last few days. The Republicans have latched onto this just as another simple excuse to engage in both in union bashing and bashing labor rights, and also bashing the Obama administration for supposedly engaging in this job-killing regulatory agenda. So, you know, they of course will not compromise. I mean, they would like to drag this on for as long as possible. The Republicans who are opposed to the board, to the rights it protects, and to the Obama administration. But for the company, clearly the sensible thing would be to reach a reasonable agreement.
Yes. What I don't understand is, you know, why average everyday working people would be swayed away from the workers and to the company side. I just don't get that. I mean, they're basically telling you we're going to use South Carolina as a wedge between the right. folks in Washington, and we're going to pit them against each other.
Yes. Yeah, and that's, you know, clearly exactly what they're trying to do, is that they've tried to frame this issue as South Carolina versus Washington State, right to work versus non-right to work, North versus South. All of these things are completely irrelevant during the dispute, saying that, you know, here you have a company that's creating jobs in the U.S. and that this is the kind of action that will likely drive. There's not a single job being created in the U.S. here. These jobs were already in the U.S.
Yep.
The question was whether or not they were going to be located in Washington State or in South Carolina. And if, you know, and what reason that the company chose South Carolina over Washington State. But Boeing is a company that receives billions of dollars, $19-20 billion of government contracts, of taxpayer money, and has outsourced thousands of jobs in recent years. Boeing should be locating jobs in both Washington State and South Carolina without pitting the workers in those states and the states themselves against each other.
Absolutely. Again, the piece is Labor Woes Make Dreamliner Delivery a Bittersweet Celebration for Boeing, written by our friend John Logan, director and professor of the Labor and Employment Studies Program there at San Francisco State University. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. John, thanks for taking time for us. Always great talking to you, and as this moves down the road, we'd love to talk to you again.
Very glad to be on. Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts after this.
Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the time's mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And then there were 12. When the 435 House members and 100 senators failed in July to agree on a long-term deficit reduction plan, the leaders did what they often do when they don't know what to do. They appointed a committee. But don't sneer, for this is, cue the trumpets, a super committee. Made up of only a dozen lawmakers and perfectly balanced between Repubs and Dems, this panel is to find about $1.5 trillion in spending cuts and new revenues to shrink the federal deficit. The theory is that the group will be small enough to work together across partisan lines for the good of the country, independent of the competing budgetary needs of various groups and the demands of special interests. The problem with theories is that reality has a way of intruding on their perfection. In this case, the intrusion is literal. The 12 Solons will not be sitting at the table alone, for such names as AT&T, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Citigroup, and GE have been escorted inside by the members. They'll not go in physically, but monetarily, for they are among the top donors of campaign cash to the 12 budgeteers, giving them an advantage over us plain citizens. For example, Wall Streeters have invested $17 million in the campaigns of the Super Committee's six Republicans and $15 million in the six Democrats. That pile of political money will be a screaming presence in the negotiating room, for members will be thinking about their need to get more of it for the next election and will not want to offend donors. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, one of the first decisions reached by the committee members was that they would allow themselves to continue collecting campaign donations while they decide whose programs and subsidies get cut and whose don't. How do you think that's going to work out?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Now, this afternoon, there were a bunch of rallies over at the Capitol today as this being the week that they're all back, this afternoon, a bunch of women's groups were out from across the state. They converged on the Capitol to speak out against what's been an all-out assault on women's rights by conservatives in the state legislature. The We've Had Enough rally was held to protest Senate Bill 732 and Senate Bill 3. And again, these are just more restrictions on women's rights, their health care rights, their reproductive rights. The organizers of We've Had Enough say that in the first 6 months of this year, the Pennsylvania legislature spent roughly 30% of their voting days here in Harrisburg attacking women's health care. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. That the conservatives here in the state want to put government between women and their doctors. 30% of the time. 30%. And one would think, with the economy being where it is, 30% of that time should be spent figuring out how to create jobs. But again, it's not about that. It's about distraction. It's about diversion. The voter ID thing that makes sure, hey, let's figure out how we can suppress the vote, keep it down so we keep winning our elections. And then the big electoral college rig game. Oh, let's figure out how we can steal the state of Pennsylvania for the Republicans. Again, more diversion away from the reality that they don't know what to do. All they keep saying, we need more tax cuts. Tax cuts will create jobs. If that were the case, the Bush years would have been full employment. We'd be importing people at an alarming rate to keep the jobs here. But that wasn't the case. And, I look at these attacks and, all of the attacks on women's rights, all the attacks on workers' rights, all the attacks on our rights. I mean, we're going to be, I go back to my history teacher saying, you better learn your history because then you'll see it coming back around again when you have to fight it. We're seeing history repeating itself. We're going back to the 90s, the 1890s. And we're going to refight all of those battles of the past. And I tell women, you should be the ones fighting the hardest. Yeah, what was it, 1920? When they got the right to vote?
Suffragettes. Right around that time.
And you look in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they're going to be able to vote in 5 years. Women in Saudi Arabia will be able to vote, I guess, maybe in 5 years is what they're saying. Perhaps. If they're lucky. Is that what we want to go back to? And I saw this story today. Saudi Arabian woman who launched this campaign to push for driving rights because they want to drive their own car. They'd like to drive themselves to the store, please.
evidently for getting behind the wheel of their car. Not driving, just getting behind it. She's going to be lashed 10 times with a whip for defying the ban. They're saying it's the first time a legal punishment has been handed down for a violation of the longtime ban in the ultra-conservative Muslim nation. And again, you know, the Muslim part of it doesn't affect me, because we've got ultra-conservative Christians here that I think right in line. And it's, you know, it's scary stuff when you let these theocrats take over and you let the corporate special interests take over. You lose your rights. You know, Mr. Boeing, he has the ability to spend unlimited amounts of money to uphold his rights. And as we talked about with John Logan, Boeing knows they're going to lose this. They knew it from the beginning. It's clear cut. It is, you know, the information that the machinists have, which is slowly coming out, and the more, I'm telling you, more is coming. It's clear cut. It is cut and dry. It's been decided in the past. There's no way around this. Boeing is going to lose. It's just a matter of when. How many decades down the road can they continue to fight this? How much money can they put in this? You and I, we don't have that ability. But Mr. Boeing, he's got big bucks. In fact, they've got every one of the Republican candidates for the president of the United States, every one of them. That's power. Mr. Smith doesn't have that. Mr. Long doesn't have it. You don't have it, but Mr. Boeing does. That's power. Also, you want to talk about more diversion? You want to talk about more non-job creation? Well, Pennsylvania's Senate Judiciary Committee, they passed out legislation that would, according to the ACLU, expand the state law to collect DNA from people charged with crimes. Not convicted, charged. If you're arrested, wrong, you know, for whatever reason, if you're charged with it, they're going to take your DNA. That's what Senate Bill 775 would do. It's going to expand the right of the state to collect DNA from folks. And I got to ask the question, are you now guilty until proven innocent? I mean, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? I guess now we're going to collect your DNA and we're going to hold on to it because we know you're going to commit a crime in the future. You know, it's like these cameras they're putting everywhere. Are we living in a police state, and who are they protecting? Are they protecting us from each other? I don't think so. You look on Wall Street, we know who they're protecting there. And it's not us from each other. It's them from us. We're funding the investor class's ability to stay clear of us. I mean, it's really quite remarkable that they've convinced us that we need all of this protection because, you know, the terrorists might win. And I got to be honest, the terrorists have won. I don't know if you've awakened to that fact. Life in this country has changed irreparably. There's no going back. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle. They won. Simple. I went to Liberty Island. Liberty Island, where the Statue of Liberty is, where Lady Liberty is, the beacon of freedom. And I had to take my belt off twice. Once to get on the boat to take the boat, the ferry ride across, and then once when I got off. And I'm going, well, I just went through the whole security thing, empty my pockets, take my belt off. Okay, yeah, that's my wallet. I went through that on the mainland. You get to the Liberty Island, mind you. I get off. The first thing I see are four guys holding machine guns with SWAT uniforms on, Liberty Island. And then right through the detectors again. Take off my belt. Take off my... What else you got? Nothing. I just came across. Do you think I swam? But that's America, man. You go through New York. We went to the Empire State Building. Just wanted to go up to the Empire State Building. Had to go through metal detectors. Had to go through, take off your belt, go through the same thing. They won. This nation is changed. Congratulations. We are a changed people.
I think one thing a lot of Americans don't understand, a lot of Americans are perfectly willing to put up with that, Rick, but in my mind, the thing that separates us from those who killed 3,000 in 2011 is the fact of our freedoms. That differentiates our society from their society. And the irony is now, in reaction to their killing, we are actually reducing the freedoms that we have. And you're, in a sense, you're absolutely right. In a sense, they have one.
I mean, you know, it's, you know, what's that old saying that Ben Franklin's been, those who would give up the essentials of liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety or security or whatever word you want to use. Amazing stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science, folk. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the nation, our good friend Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Ken, thanks for taking time for me.
How are you today?
I'm good. You know, one of those things. I keep thinking Chris Christie's going to jump into the race, and he bites me in the behind by fundraiser saying he's not.
You know, he made that statement out in Santa Ana, California, at a real fat cat fundraiser. And earlier today, his brother told the Newark Star-Ledger that, look, unless my brother's lying to me, and he's not running. And he was kind of laughing about it. You know, the rumors have been flying, and there's been a lot of speculation. You have a lot of, you know, the so-called Republican establishment, fat cats on the East Coast here who are still sitting on the sidelines with their checkbooks, and they're looking for someone.
Yep.
And I think that's behind this thing. But you have to take the man at his word. I mean, he has said, listen, not only has he said, I'm not running, but he has said, I'm not running because I'm not ready for prime time yet. Do I have to commit suicide to prove to you people that I'm not running?
Yeah, but here's the thing, and I agree with all that. I don't think he's ready. And if they come to him and say, look, the party's screwed. Mm-hmm. Look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. There's nothing there. They're, every one of them, down the line, loser. What's that?
I understand that argument wholeheartedly,
Yeah. Except
for I also think that they've already tried to make it to him. And, you know, the other thing that you have to keep in mind is, aside from the fact that you have him on film saying what I just said, outright saying, I'm not ready, which is an ad that it doesn't write itself, it's recorded itself.
Yeah.
You also have him going after the Tea Party types who attacked his nominee for the state Supreme Court, who's a Muslim. Remember that?
Yeah.
And he said, hey, enough with the Sharia.
Yeah, here's the thing. At the end of this, when your time comes, when the time comes, either you seize the moment, because you don't know what 2016 looks like. You don't know
true.
What 2020 looks like.
With the Barack Obama argument.
Yeah. I mean, if his time is now, and I'm sure he's still got time to make that decision, but you're right.
That little soundbite,
you know, I'm sure if he jumps in, we'll hear quite often.
Yeah. No, that's very, and more so. He will get attacked, You know, I mean, it'll be an interesting. It'll look like a Tea Party attack,
right,
but we know it'll be Romney,
yeah,
because that's where he bites into it. But also, I want to bring up one other point, okay? He is literally down to weeks to make a decision,
yeah,
simply because you still have to qualify to get on ballots.
Yeah, I think October 31st was, I think that's, what, New Hampshire?
Yeah, you start to get into that, and then they just keep rolling, you know, day after day after that, all the way along till the end of the year, and it really becomes a big process. I think his family has already said to him, I don't want to go through this.
Yeah, and I understand that, because like I think he said it before, I don't want to wake up at 5:30 in the morning to go shake some meat packer's hand. I don't want to do that.
Right. Right.
And, you know, work ethic, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, we'll see, though. I still cling to the, they wave enough of that green stuff under his nose and say, now's the time. He may. Because I don't see Palin being the savior. I don't see any of those, any of the Republicans that are out there now as viable candidates. I just don't. Anyway, today, not to change the subject, but just as important, to me more important, today was the Postal Service Day of Action. The Postal Unions had their Day of Action where they went around the country and to all the congressional districts and said, hey, fix this bizarre law that you passed back in 2006. Fix this so that we can continue to have 120,000 jobs and not destroy our economy. And I look at this and I say, you know, it's a no-brainer to me. Why isn't ISA allowing this out of committee?
Right. Yeah, well, that's a very good point. And we know what the answer to that is.
Yeah, they want
to
destroy it.
That committee, quite frankly, no matter which party has it, that committee is just used for political gain and to attack the other party.
Yep.
And, you know, that is just the reality. But you bring up a very good point. This economy can't take the loss of one more government job. And the big problem I have is that people throw around phrases like, we need to cut spending. We need to have budget cuts. We need to balance the budget. Okay? Well, we do need to balance the budget. There's no question about that. But you don't do it at this point by cutting programs and cutting spending. Those are not even code words for what the reality is.
Right.
And that is, my neighbor, your neighbor, the Tea Party's neighbor is going to lose a job.
But here's the thing, and you know, cutting spending is one thing. The Postal Service doesn't take a dime of federal money. It's all funded by stamps. The problem that we have right here, right now, at this very moment, is the fact that they have this bizarre pension situation where they have to pre-fund their pension 75 years into the future. No other business does that. Only Congress did this to this one entity, and I say they did it just to destroy it.
It is. We know what this is. This is union busting.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Plain and simple. This is all part of, you know, what, you know, the Koch brothers' very bizarre, you know, behavior, where somehow they think that destroying the fabric of our country, destroying the social safety net, ruining the lives of our neighbors is somehow going to preserve an outdated economic system that, quite frankly, you know, we all know is coming to, you know, an end simply because we no longer, in the age of the internet, can con foreign countries into taking, you know, into allowing our corporate masters to exploit their workers. It is just it is one of the most amazing, destructive events in the history of our nation, and it is so unnecessary. At a time when we need people to step up, like the Warren Buffetts of the world, not only to say, you know, tax me more, but people to say, you know what, I'm not going to make widgets in Malaysia anymore because I can make widgets, you know, in, pick a town, you know, John, what's the name of that great blue collar town?
Johnstown.
In Pennsylvania? What is it?
Johnstown.
That's it, Johnstown. That's where Mirtha was from, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Or where I'm from, Fall River, Massachusetts. That's what we need now, is somebody to step up and say, we need to pull our companies back into the United States and put our people back to work to preserve the republic.
Yeah, and
I
not
don't
just
think
back to work.
Fresh thoughts. I don't think this is communism. I think this is patriotism.
Absolutely, and not just back to work, as the Michelle Bachmans want to do. You know, repealing the minimum wage, because you know it's interesting you brought up Fall River, Massachusetts. Today, back in 1875, you had textile workers on strike. And you know what their demands were? Their demands were to feed their children. They wanted bread to feed their children.
It was amazing, you know. My grandfather, after he got here, just as soon as he went into the textile mills, it didn't take him long to figure out that the International Ladies Garment Workers Union was the way to go.
Yep.
And he organized, you know. And then my father after him, Teamster, you know, same deal.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to learn those lessons over again. I mean, you know, you brought up earlier when we were talking off air about the postal workers and how some people are just looking at them, you know, wanting them to go away. And those are good family-sustaining, reasonable-wage jobs that people are wishing away for one bizarre reason or another. And, you know, maybe we need to go back and starve a bit. Maybe we need to fight for bread again so that we begin again and repeat the cycle.
Well, believe me, in a lot of ways we are. You know, there's a report out today that shows that businesses and, you know, owners are passing on the cost of premiums for their health care insurance. Workers already are facing fewer pay raises, are now up against a new reality. Their bosses are forcing them to pay more for their premiums and deductibles than ever before.
Yep.
Okay? And the reason I'm segging into this right now is you and I both know that without labor setting the standard, without organized labor out there fighting and setting a standard, whether you are in a union or not, the benefits you get are spin-offs from the people who are in unions who are saying, no, we're not going to take this. We are not going to sit back and let you get multi-millions of dollars in bonuses above your million-dollar salaries while we're actually making the widgets, or while we're actually delivering the mail, or while you pick the service.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, by fighting for those rights, the companies that say, we don't want unions, hey, you know what? You don't have to have a union everywhere if you take care of your workers, okay? If you give them, you know, maximum benefits and you pay them a wage and you don't stick them, you know, for a larger premium on their family's health care costs. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, and
that's
what I found interesting.
Organized labor is important.
Yeah, what I found interesting is over the last 10 years, you've seen the premiums increase, what was it, 131%?
113%, compared to 34% for workers' wages and 27% for inflation. You know what that means? That means that when you pay more for your premiums, you've actually just taken a pay cut.
Yeah, well, your wages are going down.
That's
and
it.
And you look at the bottom line of these big corporations, and they're doing just fine, thank you very much. The shareholders doing just fine. The stockholders, all the Wall Street doing really well.
Yeah.
And all I keep hearing from people is, gee, you know, Americans, they just get too much health care. That's the reason the costs are so high, because you just get too much health care.
Right. That's the other thing. The plans that are being offered are actually offering, you know, fewer services. You know, at some point, we're going to need the doctors to check in and say, I took this Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
This is no good.
Yeah.
You know, they only go halfway. Because, as you know, the biggest problem with our education system is what we do to those guys. We teach them to do the most important job in our society, keep us healthy, and we charge them an arm and a leg at our finest teaching hospitals. You know, so they come out with these massive loans, and they're put in a position where they have no choice but to try and make a buck.
Yep.
But the fact of the matter is, don't tell me in their heart of hearts, I know, I have the best doctors in the world. I have the best general practitioner in Washington, okay? When I had my hip replacement surgery, I had one of the best cutters on the face of the earth. And I talk to these guys, you know, and they say the same thing. We're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You think we want to hurt people? We got in the business to help people. You know?
Yeah,
but that's
what
we need.
Absolutely.
We need a coming together, you know, which is what is so frustrating about the Tea Party. Those people should be with us. They should not be sitting back. It shouldn't be the truck driver who told me that, you know, I don't like seeing the signs about stimulus on the highway when they fix the roads. I'm like, you're a truck driver. They're fixing the roads. They're saving your tires. You know? Good roads means less gas. It's more money in your pocket.
There you go, thinking sense again there, Ken.
Didn't want to hear it.
Didn't want to hear it.
The guy talking about what we were just talking about, health care, going on and on and on the day of the vote. in the House of Representatives, standing outside the U.S. Capitol building, and he's going on and on about communism, socialism. You know, it isn't right. We can't do this. And I finally said to him, "Sir, you must have one heck of a good health care plan." And he said, "Oh, I got the best. I'm on Medicare."
Get your stinking government out of my health, out of my Medicare.
The noise that you could hear up there in Pennsylvania was my jaw hitting my knees. I mean, it was unbelievable.
And you know, the hypocrisy, just, you know, the ignorance.
But it's more than that. We have to be able to talk to these people. We have to be able to communicate and say, you're being snookered. You're being sent down the wrong path, and you're going after the wrong animal here.
But here's the thing. Like the guy I worked with who was going to New Haven, Connecticut, and ended up in Canada, and I asked him, you know, why you were going in the wrong direction and why you didn't stop. He goes, you know, I was making good time. So there's your answer. Sometimes, even if you're going in the wrong direction, you're making good time, and you don't want to pull over. So there you go, Ken. Always great to talk with our good friend Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ken.
Hey, man, a lot of this stuff is on the blog tonight, if you don't mind me giving a little pitch here.
Plug
the Baz
it.
File.
Yep.
You can catch up with the stories that we talked about tonight and take it from there.
All right, I'll link
you soon, okay, buddy?
I'll link it. Thanks so much.
Be well.
And now to find out what we've got going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
A story coming out of Harrisburg Patriot concerning, maybe for one last time, the mayor's reaching out to city council. The council twice has rejected her plans, and her plans for some policies that might save the city. One last chance, if in fact the council turns her down, there will be a state takeover of the city. Today the State House approved an amended version of legislation that would give the Commonwealth just that, just power, takeover power of Harrisburg. The amendment would give the governor power to declare a state of final emergency for Harrisburg and other third-class cities. The House approved the amendment to Senator Jeff Pakola's takeover bill. That's at Senate Bill 1151 by a vote of 190-7. The bill requires a final passage vote in the House that could take place either today or next week. It would then go back to the Senate for a final vote. It looks like we're coming down to the very end. There's a very real possibility, unless there's a change of heart by the Harrisburg City Council, there will be a state takeover of Harrisburg. That's a very, very unfortunate situation. A state takeover is going to require a tremendous amount of shared sacrifice and suffering for all of the city stakeholders, including the citizens of this city. Unfortunately, could have been avoided. That's a sad, sad story coming out of Harrisburg. Story coming out of the Hill. Apparently, our buddies in the Tea Party have come out against a bill by Senator Patrick Leahy. The Protect IP or PIPA Act, according to the Tea Party, they're opposing this bill because it puts severe government overreach in the area of intellectual property. According to the Tea Party, their sources tell them that there's a powerful coalition in favor of it. There's some key Democrats in the Senate who are in favor of it, some key Republicans in the House. They claim that labor is on board, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, even Hollywood. I don't know how Hollywood's on board. And some very powerful corporations. You're talking about Comcast, Ford Motor Company, Major League Baseball, and of course Walmart. And apparently what this does, puts some real tight restrictions on what the government can or can't do in case of, copyright infringement, but apparently it has a lot of support. Stay tuned on that one. It looks like that bill very well, at least initially, may pass. White House, this is according to Health Watch, the Hill Health Watch, White House won't seek a delay on the High Court health care review. The Obama administration opened the door Monday for the Supreme Court to decide the constitutionality of the health care law before the next election. It opted not to seek a delay in the legal process, leaving little doubt that the court will rule on President Obama's controversial legislation just a month before he faces voters. A three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in August that the health care law's individual coverage mandate is unconstitutional. Justice Department declined to ask the full 11th Circuit to review the decision, clearing the way for a petition to the Supreme Court. Legal experts say they expect the Supreme Court to rule on the mandate in the summer of 2012. Apparently, the Obama administration has made a tactical move to force a Supreme Court decision before the 2012 election. Health care, again, will be an important issue in the upcoming election, no matter what the Supreme Court rules. Back to you, Rick.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up.
This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, that's where you go to listen to the podcast, or you can watch the video. Also, if you have a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. If you got any comments, questions, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com, best way to get a hold of me. So, Logan, Utah. They're in the Utah State University Quad. You had 1,450 young people lined up to break a Guinness Book of World Record for the longest kissing chain. Evidently, 1,450 people, they did the whole kissing thing. And I was watching the video, and, you know, it was with boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. And as soon as the boy turned around and there was another guy behind him, amazingly, the video stopped. They cut the video right there, and I get it. You know, I don't really want to see two guys kissing either, but it's their right, not my thing. But, you know, it is Utah after all, so good luck on that getting it onto the airwaves. Not like this. Anybody ever watch the TV series The L Word? It was a series on, I think it was HBO or Showtime. It was about, you know, lesbian community and, you know, all the interacting and all that. Well, one of the stars on this, this LaShia Haley, evidently she was on board a Southwest airline flight, and, well, she was kissing her girlfriend, this Camila Gray, and someone got upset. They called a flight attendant, and the flight attendant escorted them off the plane. They got kind of into a heated argument, and
Haley went and tweeted that she had just been discriminated against and calling for a boycott of Southwest Airline by gay people. And I guess I just don't get it. I mean, why do you care? I mean, if you see two people kissing, I guess it's a lot better than seeing two people beating the crap out of each other. Right?
Absolutely. I guess my question is, you're obviously opening yourself up for a lawsuit, but why isn't that against the law? I mean, seriously, how could you kick somebody off a plane because they kissed somebody? Now, if it was unwanted, if it was, you know, you're imposing yourself, that's another issue. Then that's not really kissing, that's, you know, harassment.
Well, under what part of the law would that fall under? There is nothing about sexual orientation really in the law. You can fire people from their job for being gay. I mean, kicking you off an airplane, that seems pretty mild. Is it wrong? Absolutely.
It's also stupid in my eyes for the plane. I mean,
but they already got your money. You're not getting that back.
Well, no, wait a minute. But they probably don't realize. I'm sure they never took polls how many of their passengers are gay.
Right. And again, you know, this is one of those. The airline industry is just completely nuts. If it's not the getting on the plane, it's this nonsense now. It's ridiculous. Again, the terrorists have won. But here's the thing. I mean, you know, you go from the kissing there in Utah State University to these two young ladies kissing each other on a plane, to this story in Utah, or I mean in Arkansas, where a guy evidently approached two women, and I didn't know this was illegal. I thought it was just dumb and would get you smacked, which probably is what should have happened. But this guy went up to these two different women at two different times and offered to pay them to suck their toes. Which is kind of weird, but I don't know that it's criminal. And I think it's, you know, they're...
Well, it probably verges on stalking a little bit. We're getting into a gray area here, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, he's being charged with two counts of misdemeanor harassment. But, you know, again, you know, you look at this and you go, really? You're going to charge him with a crime because he's goofy? Because he's got some bizarre fetish? Well, you know. When does it end? And again, yeah, what are you in for? Well, I wanted to suck some woman's toes. I think that crime, being in jail for that, would keep all of the prisoners away from you. I do. I think it's just nuts enough where people would go, that guy's off his rocker.
Sorry.
Just a thought.
I'm sorry. I just find that funny.
Just a thought. Oh, I knew the toe thing would get you. I knew that.
Good Lord.
And lastly, from the great state of Louisiana, speaking of Guinness, another Guinness Book of World Record, this woman, I'm assuming she has to be African-American, she let her hair grow for 12 years. And she decided that a friend told her, hey, you know that afro you got going on there, that 4 foot, that circumference of 4 foot, 4 inches, this massive amount of hair on the top of your head, 4 foot by four inches circumference. The largest afro. A Guinness Book of World Records. Congratulations for the hair thing. And I'm thinking about this. I'm going, what could live in 4 feet of hair? I mean, think about that. That is a massive ball of hair on top of her head. I mean, you could have large animals. Sasquatch could be in that hairdo. We could have a whole commune in her head.
You could actually hide fugitives in there.
There you go. She could be a drug smuggler. She could bring entire families of Mexicans across the border. Is that what you're saying? There you go.
Anyway, if she chose to.
Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. Also, if you got a smartphone, Stitcher. See you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath put us sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy.
is coming to the USP.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Darkened.